Here's the way they look at it. Here's their metaphor for the end of innocence. Adam and Eve were held prisoner in the Garden of Eden by an unjust, cruel, and vindictive God. Until Lucifer, through his agent Satan, set man free from this garden by giving him the gift of intellect. Through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land. Every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 10th of October 2025, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol city centre. Don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share a moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port turned merchant venturer fiefdom. Yep, these medieval, or well, the genocidalists who sent the missions over to North America to slaughter, well, roughly 5 million North American Indians, the merchant venturers in the City of London's Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, Holy Land Radio, a new one, in Wisconsin from 11 until 2:30 Central Time over there, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from GitHub, APK Pure, and Apple App Store. By the way, a new version of the app just uploaded yesterday, which has got our ability to put up a little special message, all sorts of other fixes, like it was becoming a bit irksome if you wanted to save the longer interviews, to listen at some point later, save them on your phone and have actual your own copies, like it's almost like having a single, isn't it, or an LP, having the MP3 for yourself that is actually your MP3, well, our MP3, but your MP3, if you know what I mean. So there's been some fixes on the app and a few little enhancements. The easiest place to get that is from GitHub, and I think I'm pretty sure that link that's there on thisweek.org.uk will take you straight to download the latest version. It's also there on the Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. We're boycotting them. No, we're not really. I'm lying. They just are really nasty when it comes to the developer, Nick. They insist on him having all of his personal private contact details up, so that people can go around and knock on his door, which is just ridiculous. You know, an email address is what GitHub asks for, and that's all you should need, isn't it, Google, really? But you're just bullies. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero-trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with the Orwellian BBC Verify, or boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes, witch hunts McCarthy style going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity, or against the rentier mob, against World War III, or against wage slavery, which is what they want, folks. Wakey wakey. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to multiplying crises, housing, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, the twisted accelerationist Armageddonist solutions are crafted by the crafty to make every crisis worse. Anyway, Netanyahu is the king of chaos, rolling out a blood-red carpet for the Zionist man-god Antichrist to come, but it's not the end of the world. Or is it? So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also local, what do I call you, Matt?
Kiwi Irish
Irish? You're not Irish.
Yes, well, I am.
Are you?
O'Brannon.
Well, a long time ago. How long ago?
I legally changed my name to O'Brannon, so I would sound Irish.
So you'd sound Irish?
Yeah. Well, my dad, my ancestors are all Irish.
Going back how many hundreds of years?
My dad was born there.
And his dad. So there's quite an Irish flavour here.
And so on.
And there's also an Irish flavour to the news, because we've got a peace deal, supposedly. But anyway, so we also got guests on this week's programme. Did a long interview this week, about an hour and a half, with Catherine Gunn, who is looking, you know, she's the Iraq war whistleblower, and she's looking at what she calls Pax Judaica. I call it Pax Zionica, which is the idea of you will only have peace if you do as we say. So that's been the Roman Empire's way, that was the British Empire's way, it was the American Empire's way, now it's the Zionica Empire's way. And I think she's a fascinating way she just explains and describes it all. And also, it's very strong links to the new money system, the blockchain, the digital currencies, and the programmable money coming down the line. Now, I mean, it annoys me really that we don't hear more from Catherine. I'd like to hear all podcasters, mainstream press chatting with her all the time, because she's a brilliant analyst. I mean, I don't agree with her about COVID and viruses exactly, but she was brilliant on this programme. She did every week, if people remember back to 2020 and early 21. She was going all the way, almost every week we spoke to Catherine, and she was doing a forensic examination of the crooked stuff that was going on during COVID. So obviously we'll be talking about the peace deal in a bit, but I think we should start with a little bit of domestic politics, since we've had all these party conferences. Matt, maybe we could start with you. What do you make of British politics at the moment? Because we've got, it's almost like the two-party system has gone, really.
Which is fantastic, really, isn't it?
Is it? Are we going to get anything better?
Well, yeah, that's the question. It could swing one way or another.
Which way, it's a dangerous
and exciting time.
If it was Tory Labour in the old days, what is it now? What's the division? What are we supposed to think? How are we supposed to think?
Well, it seems to me it's either Reform or it's going to be a coalition of Greens and the Sultana Corbyn. And I think like everything in the world, that sort of the stage of a huge opportunity for liberation, a huge opportunity for utter tyranny, you know, and either of the old two parties are going to offer that. The tyranny side, Reform, I mean, it's a real mixed bag, but there's a lot of tyranny there, as well as a few sort of levers for better democracy too. Like, he wants to bring in proportional representation, which is, like, ironically at the top of my list for what the UK actually needs, but I absolutely don't want he's got too many other policies that are just terrible, so I'm just like,
isn't that the way with politics, is that everybody you vote for has got some fundamental fatal flaw?
I don't know about fatal. I personally see the Greens and the Sultana Corbyn as being extremely hopeful. I can't see anything too drastically terrible, and there's a lot to be hopeful. I don't know if you saw the Greens' policy of no landlords. I love that one. Obviously, it's not as simple as that, but they do have a policy.
No landlord but BlackRock.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's that is the huge, in my view, the biggest issue affecting the cost of living crisis.
But anyway, before we hear from Martin, I think it'd be nice to hear your view about. So you came in, as you're coming in, I thought you were sort of crestfallen over Donald Trump not getting the Nobel Peace Prize.
Who, me? That would have been great for my ability to annoy some of my old friends on Facebook, who most of them have cancelled me anyway, so they probably wouldn't hear it anyway. But it would have been funny. But I would have also been mortified. Part of me would have been thrilled because I could have had something over people that cancel me. Part of me would have been mortified because, like, why the heck? But he does claim that he's bringing an end to eight conflicts. And, like, is that true? I think there is a little bit of truth to it. And I don't know about. There's plenty of other people more deserving. Top of the list is, of course, Francesca Albanese. But I also think Greta Thunberg could have been in there personally. But, yeah.
They didn't really seem to get a look in, those two.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't know. What's your take, Martin? Has Trump ended eight conflicts? has he brought?
Well, the answer to that simply is no.
No, it's not. It's yes. Hang on, because what about the spat between India and Pakistan? That's just one. I mean, there's been lots like that.
I'll tell you, he definitely solved the fight between Albania and Azerbaijan, because they're nowhere near each other and they've never had a fight ever.
It's possible. So he finished that one, it's no problem. Possible for Donald Trump to stop conflicts he starts.
Well, of course, that's the thing, is if you start the conflict, you can stop it. I mean, this, what's happened in Israel-Palestine this week, Trump at any time could have picked up the phone to Netanyahu and told him to stop. So, now he has kind of told him to stop, but he could have done it before.
Yeah, well, maybe. Let's talk about that. Let's go on to that in a minute. I don't want to get too much. Anyway, Peace Prize. Well, it just seems to me, yes, you're right, Albanese, Thunberg, obvious people who should get the prize, but it's fixed. I think that's just basically
It's a fixed prize. It's become now that people recognise that it's essentially a political appointment, it's essentially the Norwegian government has to decide ultimately who they can veto who gets.
Has it sold out yet, less or more than Eurovision?
Well, I'd say less. At least Eurovision's entertaining the idea.
Is it really?
Of not including Israel.
I can't bear either, really. It's all of the. I think it's all sold out. Anyway, look, back to British politics, because we're going to have a little look at this.
Oh, but can we just talk about Maria Machado for a moment, too? Like, what is her? What are her attributes? Why has she won it?
Because she,
she's in the Venezuelan opposition party, and everyone can see how much the US is coveting Venezuela's oil. She's, and her policy is to privatize the Venezuela's oil. Maduro, the fascist dictator, wants to nationalize it.
He wants to keep it nationalized.
And she's getting the Nobel Peace Prize. Her only other policy that I'm aware of is that she wanted to move the Venezuelan, embassy to Israel, and she wants to fully support Israel.
Well, she even said to Netanyahu, can you send some soldiers to help me here, please?
Oh, wow.
Well, that's like Jeremy Corbyn.
To Venezuela.
Jeremy Corbyn phoning up Putin and said, please, can we have a few jets here? I'm having a problem with the Labour Party.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, she's definitely, she's from the wealthy classes in Venezuela, who obviously hate Maduro and they hated Chavez before him.
Anyway, so we're in a state. The two-party system seems to be going down the drain. But when you've got Farage basically reigning supreme.
That wouldn't be great.
The lovely Neil Goodwin, an old mate of mine, he was one of the co-directors of the Battle of the Beanfield film about the called Operation Solstice from the 1980s, about the police smashing into the peace convoy, traveller convoy, and destroying the whole sort of free festival scene really in the 1980s. Neil says, and he said on this programme, he said that he's worried that Farage is going to get a shoe in because of the way the Labour Party is behaving, mainly because of Starmer, Blair, Mandelson, and the people now running the Labour Party have steered it so close to the corporate, becoming a corporate party, World Economic Forum policies, that this is almost a shoe in for Farage, that actually a lot of this is Starmer's fault.
Of course it is. Labour and the Tories have both, they've merged into the same party. I say that's actually not true. I think Labour is far, far worse. Certainly on foreign policy and now on domestic policy, arguably too. The digital ID, gosh. No one wants that. And, but I am hopeful.
Tony Blair does.
Yeah, that's right. I am hopeful, though, in the Corbyn and Soltana thing. A lot of people have lost, they certainly lost a bit of the early momentum with this, but I think they can get over that. And they have already expressed intentions of working with the Greens and vice versa.
Well, Molly BBM is a TikToker. She had this to say about the digital ID.
Tony Blair wants digital ID for all of us, and he said that we need a digital system that the governments can know who've been vaccinated and who hasn't. But who funds his institute? Because it isn't the public, it's Larry Ellison. Larry Ellison, the billionaire co-founder of Oracle, who gave the Tony Blair Institute tens of millions, who also happens to be the single biggest private donor to the Israeli Defence Forces. Surprise, surprise, look who's buying TikTok. Oracle, led by Larry Ellison. Him, along with other pro-Israel billionaires, are planning to spend $14 billion to take over the app. Oracle will take 15% and run the algorithm, so that means they decide what shows up in your feed. So to spell it out, The guy that's bankrolling Blair's digital ID push is the single biggest donor to the IDF and is now linked to a plan where Blair could run the post-war in Gaza and is buying the app where millions of people get their news on Palestine. The same people are lining up to control your health data, your social media feed, and even territory. It's funny to me how it's always the same people, but surely this spells it out enough for you. But it probably won't, so I'll just pop my tinfoil hat back on. I'm just going to connect the dots.
Molly BBM, B letter B, B and M. Don't know anything about her, but she, you know, if you just look up, I did a little sort of search after hearing that, put all this, she's absolutely right. She's doing some real important dot joining.
Yeah, yeah, that's Blair, right.
Larry Harrison. This is the Israel lobby, basically.
Yeah, it's really the Western power interests, isn't it? The big money power interests. I sort of, you know, people say Zionism. It's really bigger than that, isn't it? Isn't it like just the big money Western, you know, Israel is like the fantasy football team of Western empire. You know, and if it wasn't them, it would be someone else. People say Israel's controlling the US and the UK. And of course, there is a control feedback mechanism going on, but it's really the big interests of the West. Like you said earlier, Trump could have stopped Netanyahu in his tracks at any friggin' point, just saying, I'm cancelling the checks. It's not, I get a little frustrated when people constantly say, it's Israel controlling, because it's, that's what they want you to think, that it's like a puppet on the hand of the empire. They want you to blame Israel for all the horrible things they're doing. Oh, it's just dastardly. You know, David Lammy standing up in Parliament saying World it's
Socialist,
terrible it is.
World Socialist website is reporting that Barry Weiss, who's from the Israel lobby, is taking over CBS News in the United States. Martin, it sounds to me as if the Israel lobby, although it's lost, really, the moral arguments and the hearts and minds argument, it's just buying up all of the mass media, mainstream media and social media to try to control what people are seeing and what they're not seeing, right? And this is happening as this peace deal is being signed. It's almost as if, oh, no, nobody likes us anymore. They all think we're terrible. We've suffered terrible reputational damage. Why don't we just buy up those advertising boards and put all our stuff all over it?
Well, that is what's happening, obviously. I mean, Netanyahu, when he was in the US the other week, was saying that we got seven fronts in the war, and the eighth front, I think it was, is the hearts and minds of people in the United States. So then, you know, they work. I mean, there's an interesting theory that Ron Unz came out with this week, which is that Charlie Kirk was about to, as we know, denounce Israel. And this, even in the Daily Mail, they were saying that the Israeli lobby were threatening him.
Well, he'd begun to denounce them already.
Yes, that's right. He'd already begun to denounce them. And you'd say, well, why would that be a problem? Because, you know, at the end of the day, they could probably get different mechanisms for dealing with him. But what Unz is pointing out is Tucker Carlson's 5-point series on 9/11. I don't know if any of you have
Seen it. I haven't really warmed to it, really.
Well, the point about it is nothing in there would be surprising to people in this room or most of the people listening to this show, but Tucker Carlson has a massive audience in conservative America. Now, what happened, he was about to launch the show on the day of, he was going to do it on 9/11.
It was delayed.
But it was delayed because Charlie Kirk was one of his friends, and so therefore he had to. And of course, what would have happened subsequently is Carlson would have had Kirk on his show, and they would have been talking about 9/11. Now, this rang bells in Mossad, yeah? Because if we can pin 9/11 on the Israelis, and of course we can, then it's not just sanctions, it's elimination of this rogue state. And they are very well aware of that. So, at a certain point, this is interesting, because in actual fact, after 25 years, 9/11 could end up being at the centre of world politics, as it's been for the last 25 years, but with the boot on the other foot.
Yeah, but instead of Charlie, we're going to be hearing from the Tucker Carlson show later on. He's had a very interesting guest this week, over last weekend actually, talking about the occult, and with loads of references to Nick Land. And this is what he's saying basically, is that much of what we're seeing is are things which have been being cooked up for thousands of years, hundreds of years. Things like We've heard David Livingstone on this programme talking about the idea of AI being the golem, the idea of creating life, even if it's artificial. It looks like life. It seems like life. But anyway, look, I do want you to answer what you think about the UK politics, Martin, as well, in all this, because we have got we've just had all the party conferences, the Greens as well. We're going to hear a little bit from each of them now, for a bit from Farage, which I'm sure you'll love, and also a bit from the Conservative Party and from the Greens, who've been on this week. So what do you think's actually going on?
Well, I mean, what's happening is the breakdown of the two-party system, obviously. I mean, we've had a more than two-party system for quite a while, and of course in certain parts of the country that's always been true, and of course the first past the post setup means that it makes it very, very difficult to make anything work. Mm-hmm. Because if this was a normal European country, having the spread of views we've got on a number of different parties wouldn't be a problem. Just normal stuff. We have an election and then we have to form coalitions. If you look at the way the vote splits, it's about 55% for left-wing parties and 45% for reform and the Tories. They split that between them. Now, in a first-past-the-post election, that becomes really problematic because you can never know how it's going to split on the day. Whereas if it was a proportional system, as in Ireland or Norway or any of our neighbours, even France, they have a two-stage system, then we could actually make this work. But the problem is we're going to end up... I mean, Starmer has got a majority of over 200, and he only got 30% of the vote, and he's now down on a fraction of that.
Yeah.
But he's got total power now with that majority until the next election in 4 years' time. Now, that is not... he hasn't got a mandate. Now, if Farage won on 30% of the vote, he wouldn't have a mandate either. The point of having a proportional system is whoever wins has, in fact, got the support of at least half the population. Mm. In first-past-the-post, you can end up with people in charge who haven't got the support of the majority of the population.
You've also got some political parties being well-organised and some terribly organised.
That's also true.
And funded. So that makes a big difference.
Well, of course, that's right. So the other thing is that if the Labour Party now isn't funded by the trade unions, it's funded by the AI billionaires. Yeah, and of course they've got loads more money than the trade unions. So you'd be a mug to take the trade union money rather than the AI billionaire money, wouldn't you? If you want to win.
I mean, it is basically the breakdown of the whole political system. Anyway, look, we're going to hear from Badenoch, the Tory leader. We're going to hear a bit from Farage, his final speech to his conference, and also from Polanski. But we'll start with who is it? Farage, because he came first in the party conference season.
I'm pleased to see the membership is now up through 242,000, quarter of a million, here we come! I really believe it's been the most incredible conference. The big word that comes out of it is energy. The energy has been literally unbelievable. The enthusiasm has been extraordinary. And the fact that you've all stayed right to the very end, and what a strong end it was, wasn't it? Lucy Connolly, wow, what about that? But there was one speech yesterday that made me think deeply about our future. And that was Preston Manning, the founder of the Reform Party of Canada, a party that came from nowhere and took over the government of Canada and ran it well for 10 years. And he talked about the story of how they did it. And there was a point that he made. The point that he made was, when we had our disagreements, we had them in private. Now, you know, you can't get a large number of councillors from a county and everyone's going to love each other, that everyone's going to agree. It's not possible with human beings that could ever be the case. But my sort of big message at the end of this conference, as we head towards those massive elections in Wales, in Scotland, in London, in the Midlands, and elsewhere next year, is that you are the people's army. And to succeed, it needs one thing: discipline. Can we please exercise discipline and air our disagreements between each other in private and not in public? And if we do that, we will succeed. We will. Now, There was another speech yesterday, right at the end, that really did move me. And it was Lee Anderson, who, by the way, can be incredibly funny when he wants to be. But there was a very serious message that came from Lee yesterday, and it talked about good, sound, solid principles. He talked about his life, and it encapsulated everything we're about. He talked about his family. He talked about his community. He talked about his belief in country. He talked about getting up of a morning, going to work. He talked about self-pride, self-respect, getting on with life, not relying on others to bail you out of your problems, whilst at the same time fully understanding there are some in society who do need help. But I think we all know we're now living in a country where we're paying a lot of people not to go to work who should be going to work. And I want to invite...
I'm going to stop him there because I'm interested in this whole idea of what is really going on with the work economy, Martin. It looks to me as if the cost of living in Britain is so high, and things like national insurance for small businesses paying people is so high, it just doesn't pay to employ people. And so we've got some absolute disaster at the heart of the economy, whereby it's very difficult to actually even get businesses going. That we're living in a kind of monopolistic economy where the big multinational corporations, the big chains around the country, they can afford to operate, but ordinary people, whether it be farmers now or families in the high street or small businesses around the country, wherever they are finding it really difficult. In fact, this is deliberate.
Well, what's going on is the final working through of what we started doing in the 1980s. And we've deindustrialized the country. Most people, we've probably got a higher employment ratio than many other countries, but many people are not earning enough money to live even when they're in work.
Well, this is it. That's the point. When work stops being a route out of poverty.
That's right. Well, real wages have stagnated in this country, as they've stagnated in the United States.
So Farage is actually not addressing the root of the problem at all, is he?
No, what he's doing is rewarming the Thatcherite stuff. What we need is less regulations, lower taxes for people like me, and then the economy will spontaneously...
He's going to get all these people working, right, apparently. But where are they going to work?
Well, that's right. They're not going to work in the steel industry, are they? Because that's about to go down the drain.
They're not going to work on the high street because that's already full.
No, because the high street was already being hollowed out by internet shopping anyway.
Are they going to work in the civil service?
Well, they're not, because we're going to cut civil servants. Now, the point is, he doesn't understand anything about macroeconomics. He left school at 16 and he went to work in the City of London as a trader.
Maybe he does understand it. It's just that his audience, his voters, these are the ones that think, well, I work hard and I don't like to see people on benefits. How dare they?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what he's appealing to, but there's plenty of people who might vote for reform who are dependent on benefits. And so, in other words, he's alienating them because he's a middle class, he's an upper middle class person. He's never wanted for anything. Some of his voters are not like that. They are, in fact, dependent on things like universal credit, housing benefit, and so on. The same with Trump's voters. Now, if they vote, like turkeys, for Trump or for Farage, then they will cut their benefits, but they won't be better off. And this is the problem. This is a problem for the right all over the world.
What do you make of Farage and his little speech there, and particularly around this whole idea of, getting millions of people back to work, which seems to me absolutely pie in the sky? What do you make of the whole Farage pitch?
I totally agree with your take that it's just scapegoating, and whether or not he actually believes it. I think the same way about Trump. People say, Trump's a racist! I'm like, is he, or is he just playing his base for fools? You know, he used to use a lot of illegal Mexican immigrants to build his fabulous hotels. I don't think he actually hates them. I think he quite likes using that when he needs to, and then when they're no longer useful, he uses political collateral, doesn't he, to, you know, so it's, I think that's what Farage is doing. Perhaps Martin's right. Perhaps he doesn't understand it. He's certainly wrong. It's not going to do anything.
Well,
you know,
Liz Truss was the best. Liz Truss's budget was the best budget ever. That's what he said.
Mm. Yeah? Maybe it was. Maybe it was for the because Labour Party, the people that destroyed it were the city. They didn't like it.
No, it wasn't
but
the city.
But they shouldn't be running the country.
No, it wasn't the city that destroyed it, Tony.
The markets.
The markets destroyed it because she didn't understand what she was doing. You can't cut taxes for wealthy people unless you've worked it through the market. Now, Trump's trying the same thing. Yeah. What they're going to do is they used to believe in the free market. Now they don't believe it. They believe in tariffs. They believe in all sorts of. They don't believe in anything really. They just believe in themselves. Mm-hmm. But what's going to happen quite soon is Trump is going to crash the global economy. We really will be out of work. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we've still got full employment. We've got full employment, but people have rubbish wages and they can't pay the rent. But soon enough, they're going to be out of work. And of course, Nigel Farage on the right wing will say, what we need is, I don't know what we need, more free market? Or are we going to nationalise things? He's hinted at nationalising things. Now, for years and years and years, he was in favour of privatisation. I'm sure we can find social media and other stuff from back in the day of Nigel Farage saying how wonderful it was to privatise the water industry and the steel industry. But he's now decided that they should be nationalised. But on the steel industry front, of course, that's about to be wiped out in this country because we've got tariffs from the Americans have put tariffs on us and the Europeans have put tariffs on us and therefore British steel production becomes unviable. Oh, there's nothing you can do about it. That's it.
Well, this, as we were saying the other week about Jaguar Land Rover, this is a kind of fingers crossed, will it work? Like Westlands with Michael Heseltine many years ago. These are all industries that just we cannot just simply can't do here because of the cost of labour more than and
it's
also of course
the cost of
and the cost of energy.
So the cost of energy is a result of the Americans blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the one thing nobody will be discussing.
And of course you love to talk about that as the only cause, but it's not. It's also the fact that the energy markets have been monopolised.
That's right, by the private sector. Now, who privatised the energy market in this country?
The mates of Farage.
Yes, it was Margaret Thatcher, and Nigel Farage was cheering it on all the way. He was a city trader, he made loads of money out of it.
And we're living in a world of price fixing.
Dulwich College.
Well, why not?
He left at 16.
I nearly went to Dulwich College, by the way.
Yes, well,
luckily I didn't.
What a fine fellow you turned into.
I wouldn't have met Nick if I hadn't have gone to Dulwich College. But anyway, look, you can't blame anybody for what school they go to. When you're aged, whatever it is, 11 years old, you are not in a position to decide your future. When you go to university, yes, so this is one of the things that frustrates me, Martin, about you. I'm going to shout at you for a change. What frustrates me about you is you blame people because of the school they went to.
All right, can I just say this about Farage. Yesterday he was at a private school in the United States and he attacked all the teachers in Britain and said that they are basically encouraging black kids to think they're oppressed and that white kids are oppressing them and we're going to have to do something about that. And all I can say is he's never been in a state school and I bet his kids don't go to state school either. We don't do anything like that in our schools. That's not how it works at all.
Anyway,
and the reason he doesn't know about it is because he's never been there. My parents, both sides, were state school teachers. He knows nothing about what goes on in state schools.
It's not their fault.
No, it's not their fault. It's not his fault. His fault, he doesn't understand how schools
maybe
operate.
Maybe he doesn't care.
No, he doesn't care. And his voters don't care.
Yeah.
He says that
Martin, just a second.
Teachers are going to go on strike against him.
I'd like to. Because I mean, what we're doing here is we're looking at the connection here between the cost of labour and also the financial system, right? So this is a clip from Nick Griffin. We played this last year sometime, the former leader of the British National Party, who talks about the days when the Tommy Robinson Brigade turned up back in Luton, in Bedfordshire, and they had some proposals. It was all American money, the same American money which is buying up social media now and CBS News and others, and what they were proposing to do with the British National Party back then, which is quite, I mean, to me, this is at the root of so many of our problems, and I guess this is quite close to the whole Farage argument, because he's trying to be a nationalist, but this is what happened to the BNP. This is what the American money was trying to do.
Out of all the groups, the most important one by a mile was the English Defence League, British Freedom Party. That was a serious, systematic, hugely funded effort by a section of the ruling elite, by this Zionist neocon clique, to dominate, to simply take over nationalism and turn it into their tool to encourage the white working class to go and fight their wars, and so that when the banking collapse comes, people are looking in the wrong direction instead of the real culprits. This party, we were approached. I was approached we were offered money from the United States, and all they wanted was two things. They only wanted us to concentrate on Islam, and I yield to no one in my criticism of Islam and grooming. I put my neck on the line. Many of you have put your neck on the line as well. But it's not the only problem. And they wanted us only to focus on that, and it only came with one other thing. They wanted us to drop our criticism of the banking system. Those were the only two things. We had to concentrate on talking about Muslims, and we had to drop our criticism of the international banking system.
So that's Nick Griffin, the former leader of the British National Party, who was booted out of the British National Party as a result of not taking that US money to become basically a part of the Israel lobby and against criticism. Well, the one thing that I think is you can understand why the Israel lobby would want to get a nationalistic party like the BNP, like Tommy Robinson, to campaign against Muslims, be pro-Israeli, because they're building up for a Holocaust or a genocide, whatever it is they're trying to do in Gaza. But the banking system, this to me is a little bit of a curveball. So what is it about the banking system that the Israel lobby is so afraid of? I mean, that's the sort of thing, I suppose, that was being campaigned in all sorts of fringe parties. The Green Party was talking about it, by the way, back in the noughties and the 1990s too, that we need to reform the banking system.
Well, that's the whole point. We need to reform the banking system. And what they're saying is we don't want to reform it. Lay off the banking system. Yeah? The Zionist billionaires, and there are lots of non-Zionist billionaires, but they tend to support Zionism. They want everybody to talk about anything else but the banking system, which is why we spent, after 2008, a lot of time talking about Brexit and not so much time talking about banking.
So what should we be doing with the banking system? Let's just have some ideas from both of you, because this is the one thing they don't want us talking about. Let's talk about it.
Well, honestly, Tony, what we'll have to do, when it crashes, which it will do, we could have nationalised the banking system in 2008. Yeah,
I don't want to know what we haven't done.
It's going to crash again. When it crashes again, we'll nationalise it and we'll keep it in the public sector. We need to actually create money creation by the state rather than by the private sector.
You know, funny enough, Farage was talking about this, wasn't he?
Yes,
he wasn't hinting. We had Steve Hall on discussing it a few months ago. Farage is actually going there to a certain extent, so he's not behaving himself. Anyway, what do you think? Is anything, any ideas, thoughts that you've got about any fixes for the financial system? At the moment, it's the Treasury, the Bank of England.
Yeah. By the way, are you saying Farage was wanting to reform the UK banking system?
He was talking about, well, because a lot of the money that the government spends, they borrow. He's saying you don't have to do that. You can just make it up. The Bank of England can just create that money. And very few people have been talking about this. Obviously, that puts you in debt to the banks. It means the government is in debt. And he's saying, well, we don't need to be paying that interest. Let's just stop paying it. So he's been talking about some sorts of fundamental reforms, which go over most people's heads, I think. But anyway, what are your thoughts about banking and what we can do, money?
It's a subject that I know I need to look more into, and that it does seem to be often the top of the pile of where things are coming from. The central banks, they seem to be able to sporadically make a war happen anywhere there isn't a central bank, and then, oh, there's a central bank there now. So it seems like something we all need to actually pay attention to. Well said, that yes, anything that they're trying to stop you talking about, definitely could talk about.
I would add to this is the Bradbury Pound. In fact, I'd quite like to put a nice picture of Bradbury Pound on the show page this week at thisweek.org.uk.
What's the Bradbury Pound?
The Bradbury Pound was created by the Treasury back in the First World War because they were running out of money. So they said, we need to actually have some creation of money here. So the argument from some economists, Martin, I'm not sure what Martin would say about it, but is that if you start creating money, you get runaway inflation or prices start going up. Well, it depends. It depends who's got that money. If poor people have got that money, surely they're going to be spending it in small shops, and they'll be helping small businesses, and there won't be runaway inflation. But anyway, Martin, is the idea of a Bradbury Pound, the government creating money, just spending it out there into the economy, is it a bad idea? Would it work?
No, it's a good idea, and of course it did work. I mean, what they said at the beginning of the First World War, the stock markets collapsed, the various contending powers ran out of money. And of course, that was an argument before the war, is that there won't be a world war because they'll run out of money after the first few weeks and they'll have to stop. But of course, they didn't stop. They just started printing money. And of course, it could cause inflation. But then you have to bring in things like price controls, which is what they did. But if you're going to have price controls and government money creation, guess what? It's not a free market economy anymore. We're moving away from the whole free market.
There was a trend in the 1990s for LETS, wasn't there? Local exchange and trading system, local money. But it never really picked up. It never took off.
Well, because it's not real money.
You couldn't use it. Well, you could exchange it with shops. But anyway, this is a very powerful monopoly, isn't it? The means of exchange. So anyway, we've had Farage. And we've talked a little bit about some of his party's ideas. What about next, Polanski and the Greens? So let's have a listen to... He's the sort of tail end of his leader's speech at the end of the Green Party conference this week.
The one politician in the cabinet who at least half gets the issue, Ed Miliband, have tried to sack him. They have failed us on climate. Like they have failed us on so many things. And we are now... And while I'm thanking people, I want to thank all the patriots working inside the Green Party, because you're all working towards the goal of a better country, from our MPs, our peers, our assembly members, our councillors, our staff team, all our volunteers, every single one of you, for putting in this work for our country. Thank you. We've got a huge amount of work to do. In just a few months' time, we have an incredibly important set of elections, and our sights are set high. Look at next year alone, and get ready for some bold politics. We are fighting to win our first ever directly elected mayor in Hackney. In fact, we're campaigning to win more seats in more places than ever before. And we are on the very cusp of winning our first ever green seat on the Senate. And that's just the first step. Piece by piece, brick by brick, we are building a party that represents every corner of this country. So that in 2029, or whenever the general election comes, we will be fighting to win more seats than ever before. We will convert our 39 second places into many new MPs. So whether it's Anthony Slaughter and Tessa Marshall in the Senate, or Zoe Garbett and Dylan Lauren Hackney, are the hundreds of people who we will turn into councillors, we are not messing around. We are here and we are ready to win.
Okay, that's enough of that. Not too much in the way of policies, but I guess we know pretty much what green policy. One of the ones they were talking about this week, and he announced in that speech, Martin, was the legalisation of all drugs.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting policy, and one that I actually support. Mm. But of course, it's a minority view as we speak. Not amongst police officers, I have to say, but amongst leader writers in the Tory press.
So what do you make of the idea of getting rid of all drugs? It'd be nice to have had that up. What I'll do, I'll put the full speech up.
Legalising all drugs as opposed to getting rid of them all. Yes, legalising. Yeah, I actually do. I grew up not thinking that. It sounds crazy, and that's why I think the general population, as Martin says, may not be on board with it yet. But like many things, if you actually look at the detail of them and the experience where in countries which have at least decriminalized or legalized drugs, even the more pernicious and addictive ones, it has the opposite effect that you'd think. Usage goes down. And one thing that comes to the top of that equation is that you can control the sale of cannabis, and then you can tax it, and then you can take that money, which is otherwise just, you know, not being taxed, not being used for public good, essentially, and you can put that into mental health for people that do actually need treatment. And of course, there are some, you know, so many people enjoy drugs and have very few, you know, serious negative outcomes, but there are some. There is some that do. And for those people, if you can tax the sale of it, you can put that into the rehabilitation efforts, the education efforts, health treatment efforts. It just seems to make a lot of sense. And the whole idea that, oh, drugs are, you know, we don't want young people to go, well, make it ID'd so that you're going to buy, if you're going to go buy cannabis, you need to see some ID. Now, for other drugs, like heroin, of course, we're not going to control the sale of that and be, but I think making it, decriminalizing it or legalizing it does actually seem to make it an issue that, you know, can be treated as a health issue, not a criminal issue, which makes sense.
Well, I think the other thing is that the criminal gangs that are trading in drugs, they often just pay the police off, don't they?
Right.
So the cops are getting two salaries, they're going to have to start paying the police more.
Well, the real problem is in the countries where it's produced, like Colombia, where I was in a trade union
delegation.
And of course,
we do like to talk about drugs. There's actually lots of different sorts of drugs. You're just about to talk about cocaine, Martin. Just explain.
Well, I was going to talk about the fact that the real problem with the drugs is not the actual drugs. There's obviously some issues with cocaine, just as there is with
vodka. Well,
there's
some massive issues with the drugs, with ketamine. We have people stumbling around in our street the whole time on drugs.
Okay.
And go to Vancouver, you'll see whole roads and streets full of people on fentanyl and things like this.
The real problem is in the countries of production is the killing that's associated with the industry. People die every day from gunshot wounds and assassinations.
Well, some people say the only reason we went to Afghanistan was to safeguard opium.
Well, in actual fact, that's what happened. In the original Afghan war in the 1980s, when Al-Qaeda was created by Nigel Farage's hero, Margaret Thatcher, that was funded partly by... The whole campaign was funded largely by our taxes, but also by turning a blind eye to heroin production. The ISI and the Pakistani military basically went into heroin production, and I remember it happening. Heroin just started appearing all over the streets in Britain, and that was funding our war against the Soviets.
Oh, who stopped the poppies? The Taliban. Oh,
that's right.
Oh, the evil Taliban.
That's right. Now, the point about all of this stuff is it is a social issue in developed countries, but the real problem is in the countries of production, and it's not so much the actual use of the drugs, it's all of the dirty money that gets... politics in Colombia, if you think politics in this country is corrupt, in Colombia, the right wing are funded, they are drug dealers, and of course they're protected. So the guy in Ecuador now, the president of Ecuador, he's just been pushed in by the Americans. His family, the Noboa family, are major drug dealers. They're undoubtedly they're the biggest, richest family in the country, and they use their banana business to deal
it's
drugs,
important to talk
and the DEA turns a blind eye.
It's important to talk about different drugs, not just cocaine. There are all sorts around, aren't there? Like amphetamines, for example.
Well, amphetamines have been around for a long time.
Very addictive, for example, can't they?
Yes, but there's all sorts. I'm looking at a kitchen... unit there. If you go into the kitchen, there'll be some cleaning materials in there. You can sniff those and you can get high.
The question isn't, are amphetamines dangerous or harmful? Like, they are. But it's how we deal with it. It's clear that the current situation of treating it as a crime isn't working. It's not stopping people. Like, if I want to get some amphetamines, I'm sure I could do it. I've never looked for them myself. It's not my thing. But I know that I could. And any teenage person, you know, would like, it's treating it as a health thing, so that I think was it Poland that did this trial of decriminalizing?
No, Portugal.
Portugal, yeah, and they had a huge heroin issue, which is obviously just as addictive as anything else, and they found that once they trialed this, instead of going to jail. I mean, do you really think doing prison time is going to cure you of your appetite for doing drugs? No, it's going to make you hunger for that sort
you might
of...
You might even make contacts to get drugs. And
exactly.
Start
also, prisons are often places where there's plenty of drugs.
So they offered these people, instead of like jail time, they offered them rehabilitation. And I don't even think it was compulsory. Maybe
no,
it was.
No, because if you make it compulsory, it won't work. It's a waste of time saying to somebody, yes, we'll give you, we won't send you to prison, but you've got to give up whatever you're doing. Heroin is actually quite a simple one to deal with. In 1968, Dr. Marks in Widnes, where I'm from, he started just prescribing heroin to people who are addicted.
Mm.
So you can only take a certain amount of heroin.
Can I just also say the super rich, some of them, heroin addicts, yes, and they get very nice pure heroin,
I understand
and they have it every day, and it might be that many people who know them have no idea.
That's right. Well, Elon Musk has got a little box, hasn't he, with it all in. You wonder, is he ever arrested? I suppose when you're the world's richest man, you don't get arrested, do you?
So what? The video of
it's just kids on the street.
The video of Zelensky and Starmer and Macron. It was clearly cocaine
on
the table.
It's at every level.
It's utter hypocrisy, isn't it?
It is, and the cocaine industry has been very, very important in supplying the right-wing paramilitary death squads in Colombia, the Unidos Defensas de Colombia, and Uribe, who was the president, was a major drug dealer.
What's going on with these boats in Venezuela?
Just hang on a second. Just stick on the drug stuff, because we've also had cocaine. Various investigations have found massive amounts, far too much cocaine in the toilets of the BBC and the Houses of Parliament.
Well, that's right, because it's become a ubiquitous drug used at every level. And of course,
and you get these BBC guys who've got this amazing, wow, and
you're a cokehead, aren't you? Okay,
that's right. But I mean, the point is that if you want to manage it, you've got to just say. I mean, I think cocaine is particularly problematic. Unlike heroin, heroin is less problematic because it only takes so much heroin in a day. Yeah, there's a limit. The thing about cocaine, it's a bit like booze. Once you started, you want some more.
Ah, yes, that's
another drug. But anyway, in fact, that's not illegal.
Have
is
we
it?
Talked about all different sorts of drugs?
No, because of course we haven't. Because there's hundreds and thousands.
Well, there's another type of drug which happens to be around this time of year.
Oh.
It's called a mushroom, and I found it interesting because it is just right around about now. If you know what they look like, they've got they're called the Liberty Cap. They've got kind of dark gills. They've got a creamy colour. They're shaped a little bit like a bell. And there's all sorts of theories around about how good they're, because it's not addictive either. Mm. Hallucinogenic drugs are not. Now, LSD is a synthetic compound made from this sort of substance. So let's have a listen now to a little report on psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms.
Psilocybin changes the brain, but not the way anyone expected. When neuroscientists finally put volunteers in MRI machines and gave them psilocybin, they thought brain activity would explode. More neural firing, more energy, more chaos. Instead, they saw the opposite. The brain got quieter. Specifically, one part went almost silent. The default mode network. The default mode network is your brain's control center. It's the voice in your head. The thing that says, I, when you think about yourself. It creates your ego. The boundary between you and everything else. Your sense of self. On psilocybin, that shuts down. Not partially, not temporarily, the entire network goes offline. And when it does, something extraordinary happens. Brain regions that never talk to each other suddenly connect. The visual cortex starts communicating with areas that process emotion. Memory centers link up with parts that control body awareness. It's like every neighborhood in a city suddenly building roads to every other neighborhood. Robin Carhart-Harris at Imperial College London discovered this in 2012. He called it neural anarchy. But it wasn't anarchy. It wasn't chaotic. It was reorganization. The connections formed during these psychedelic experiences don't just disappear when the drug wears off. Brain scans show new neural pathways remaining active for weeks, sometimes months. In some cases, the changes appear permanent. Johns Hopkins researchers found something even stranger. People who took psilocybin in controlled settings showed lasting personality changes. Not mood changes, personality changes. They became more open, more creative, more connected to others. This shouldn't be possible. Personality is supposed to be fixed by age 30, but psilocybin rewrote that rule. And here's what really puzzled scientists. Psilocin, what psilocybin becomes in your body, fits into human serotonin receptors perfectly. Not approximately, perfectly. Like a key designed for a specific lock. We share about 50% of our DNA with mushrooms. Somehow these fungi produce a compound that seems tailor-made for the human brain. Paul Stamets, the world's leading mushroom expert, thinks this isn't a coincidence. He believes humans and mushrooms have been evolving together, what he calls co-evolution. Brain scans prove psilocybin creates new neural connections. They prove it dissolves old patterns. They prove it fundamentally changes how we think. But ancient civilizations didn't need MRI machines to know this. They'd been using mushrooms for thousands of years. They saw them as technology, sacred technology, a way to communicate with other realms, a way to speak with our ancestors. They saw mushrooms as a way to speak to God.
So that's Zach Polanski's new policy, if you want to vote for him, is making it not illegal to pick mushrooms, process them and eat them to help you communicate with God, Martin?
Well, I mean, that's obviously a bit of hyperbole there. I think that the idea that drugs can actually be positive, I mean, David Nuss, who was the head of the government's... Yeah. Who was the head of the government's, and of course he was sacked for this, was pointing out that, you know, that things like even ketamine have been useful. They can be used positively in psychotherapy. Mm. But let's not get carried away here. There's lots of negative aspects to drugs.
Absolutely right.
Which we need to actually focus on.
Well, I mean,
the drugs that are
Rewiring the brain could be something quite useful for some of the psychopaths running the world.
Well, it could be, yes. I mean, obviously...
I don't know.
Smith.
No, go on.
I think it opens up too much freedom of thought. You know, the psychedelics...
Well, we do freedom of thought here.
I know, but the government, I mean, the powers that be don't want that, do they? It goes against everything. Anyone that wants a controlling system, yeah, it's any psychedelic or mushroom, it's going to open up too many questions. They don't like, you know, well, people want to control things, don't like that.
It's fascinating because LSD was originally used by the CIA under MKUltra to try and do brainwashing of people. And of course it leaked from the experiments they were doing into the general community and then became a recreational drug.
Did they not force it out there as well? I mean, they were experimenting on the population as well, surely.
They were. And of course,
it was the Second World War time, roughly. We're talking
later now, the 60s, early 60s. And of course, they were quite happy in some respects to create an alternative culture, which was a drug culture, rather than the other alternative culture in California, which was an anti-war protest culture in Berkeley University and the others. Yeah. So, in other words, if they're all off their heads in the park, then they're not protesting in the streets.
Well, John Potash wrote a fantastic book called Drugs as Weapons Against Us, which is exactly about that. It's about the way that drugs were used, specifically targeted against hippie culture and specific musicians. The idea is a musician, if they start taking LSD and they start talking about it as something cool, this can actually derail the anti-war movement and organized opposition.
Well, the other thing to mention, just in this quick, I'll be quick, is that the crack cocaine epidemic in the 1980s in the United States was orchestrated by the CIA. Adolfo Calero is the head of the Contras in Nicaragua, working with Barry Seal, who was a CIA agent. And of course, it was all uncovered by Gary Webb, who ultimately committed suicide by shooting himself twice in the head. So that killed several birds with one stone. It criminalized black youth inside of the United States. It created a whole kind of, you know, social conflict, but it also funded the death squads in Nicaragua and in Colombia.
Okay, well,
everybody in Colombia knows very well who runs the cocaine industry.
For me, the hallucinogenic drugs are more interesting.
Less dangerous.
You're seeing things on these drugs, Martin. Do you think what you're seeing is a deep insight, or is it just a load of nonsense?
It depends, doesn't it? I mean, you can't generalise about these things. I've got some experience in this area, but of course it's all particular. Some people have a nice time and it's positive for them,
I'm not so much talking about whether you have a good trip or a bad trip. It's more, is there any kind of real philosophical, intellectual, spiritual value
to it? Yes, I think there is. I mean, things like psilocybin, okay, which are native to this country, I think it's fairly clear that prehistoric peoples were using it. Yeah. But we've got used to the idea all we do is drink booze here. But in actual fact, I can imagine in prehistoric times people didn't drink booze.
It may have been something in those days that would be controlled by a priesthood or something.
Well, that's right. So everything is controlled by somebody. You know, all social order is based on, you know... I mean, what they do with many psychedelic drugs in traditional communities is ibogaine, for example, which comes from West Africa, that is a rite of passage for male teenagers. Everybody does it once as a male. Girls aren't allowed to do it. And of course, your dad says to you before you do it, no, think hard before you take this about what you want to get out of it, blah, 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 blah. So they pre-program them, then they give it to them. And of course, they now use ibogaine. I was talking to somebody who's had some not that long ago, to cure people of addiction. Because if you say, before you take it, I want to get off being addicted. So this woman I was talking to had been addicted to heroin. Mm. And she said, before I took it, I went to Spain to take it. I took it and I got, and I said, I said to her, you want to think really hard what you want out of it before you take it. And I wanted to get off heroin. So I want to get off heroin. And of course, I've not touched heroin 16 years ago. I haven't touched heroin. She said to me, but what I should have done is I said, I don't want to be addicted to anything. Because in actual fact, I don't do heroin
isn't that a kind of hypnosis?
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. It's, the point is that drugs are variable. Yeah. Some, they don't, they're not all the same. Ibogaine is, it's not addictive. It's a trip, well, but it's actually, it reorganizes the brain in such a way. People who've done it say, well, it just makes you look at your life you just stand outside your life and look at it and say,
I think we're talking here about mushrooms and drugs generally, but particularly mushrooms. You know, I think we should also, it comes with an advisory. Whatever you do, don't go just picking mushrooms, thinking that this is magic mushrooms and popping it, because it could be almost anything out there. So please, you know, just say that as an advisory. So from the sublime to the ridiculous, Kerry Badenoch, Tory Party speech this week.
The last Conservative government cut stamp duty for thousands of home buyers. But now we must go further. We must free up our housing market, because a society where no one can afford to buy or move is a society where social mobility is dead. So I have looked at the stamp duty thresholds to see where we can change them. I have looked at the rates you have to pay to see if we can lower them. I have decided that we can't, because that simply wouldn't be enough. Conference, the next Conservative government will abolish stamp duty on your home. It'll be gone. Thank you. That is how we will help achieve the dream of home ownership for millions. Home ownership should be a dream that's open to everyone. Abolishing stamp duty on your home is a key to unlock a fairer and more aspirational society. We cannot unpick every tax. The debt, the deficit, and the damage this Labour government is creating means we cannot do everything all at once. Scrapping stamp duty will benefit people of all ages, because conservatism must speak to all generations. The young professional buying their first flat, the couple looking for somewhere to bring up their first baby, the growing family hunting for their forever home, the pensioner who wants somewhere a little smaller or maybe to move nearer the grandchildren. No longer will they be punished with a tax that is a barrier to doing the right thing for them, for their family, and for society. And this change will bring wider benefits to our economy too. Because every time a home is sold, it triggers a chain reaction of activity. Movers, builders, decorators, flat pack furniture and DIY. Trips to Next, John Lewis and IKEA. And I can afford to do this while still leaving space within my golden economic rule. Because that's the fiscally prudent way to do things. That's what conservatives do. Conference, I want to see a better Britain, where people have a brighter and more prosperous future. The Labour Party fails when it follows its principles. We fail when we don't follow ours. We are going to follow the same timeless conservative principles which have led us to success in the past. Personal responsibility, free enterprise, family, freedom of speech. People want to know what I stand for? I stand for a government that takes less of your money and doesn't interfere in your life. Where the state does less, but does it better. Where those who create wealth are welcomed with open arms, not driven from our shores. Where reward matches effort. Where Britain stands tall in the world. I stand for an economy where profit is not a dirty word, where enterprise is supported, not crushed. I stand for a country where what you put in determines what you get out, where excellence is celebrated. I stand for a country where actions have consequences, where we talk about responsibilities as well as rights, where crime is punished and justice is served, where the welfare of victims outweighs the welfare of criminals. I stand for a society where free speech trumps hurt feelings, where everyone knows what a woman is, where people are judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, where the vulnerable are supported, but where freeloaders are told where to get off.
So I suppose the freeloaders are maybe the disabled. Are they freeloaders? So anyway, Martin, what do you make of this?
Well, it's obviously tailored to the audience she's got there. Stamp duty really is only paid by wealthy people who buy and sell houses. If you don't buy and sell houses, it's not an issue for you.
It seems a bit funny that she's saying that actually getting rid of stamp duty will help people buy houses, because that isn't the main problem, is it? Yeah, the main problem is people cannot save money. Also, the deposits that they need to buy a house are far too high. And also, the housing market is massively, massively inflated. People, a lot of ordinary houses in London, just semi-detached houses now, £1 million.
Yes, and that's the reason why the country's been deindustrialised, because all the money that should have gone into small and medium enterprises got pushed into real estate.
I mean, this country does seem to be now just working on the property market. There's nothing else going on, really.
That's right, but of course the property market, you can't export the property market. Foreigners can come in and buy, like Saudi princes.
Well, they sure do.
But that's the only export you're going to make out of it.
I was going past the Merchant Venturers headquarters, as I do from time to time, and there was a big event in there, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. Are we going to find Merchant Venturers? And I strolled up to the gates. I looked inside, and I could see it was a letting company, Sarah somebody's letting company, and so they are using that place as this is just property. You can make loads of money if you're renting out property, but how else are you going to make money? It's very difficult country to get into making money anywhere nowadays.
Well, yes, I mean, this is the fundamental problem. There is productive investment and there's unproductive investment, and people used to know when I was learning economics in the 70s what the difference was. Speculation is not productive. If you make money by flipping a house, that's good for you and you've made some money, but you've not actually contributed to production at all. Production is actually physical. You've actually got to invest in physical stuff like machinery, training, all of that sort of stuff. And of course that's not the same as building a tower block in a good location and then just renting it out to wealthy people. And of course that's the problem with our country.
Students.
Yeah, well that's the problem. She is just basically coming up with the old Thatcherite nonsense. Now of course Trump in the US, with all of his tariffs, he's thrown the free market textbook in the waste paper basket. Now, this is going to be a problem for the right wing in Europe going forward. Are they in favour of more free market? In which case, we've been doing that for 30 years, it's got us nowhere. Or are you in favour of less free market? But if you're in favour of less free market, then you're not in favour of the free market, so you're a socialist.
Well, we don't want free market in any of the utilities that were privatised by Margaret Thatcher, like transport, telecoms, water, gas, electricity, or money, by the way. We don't want the private banking system taking it all over, because what happens is it just gets concentrated in the hands of the rich. So what about, okay, so just generally, reform is riding high. It's very difficult. Okay, so we've got another 3.5-4 years before another general election. So, Martin, does it matter that Farage is doing so well? It's, I mean, this is all pie in the sky, the idea that he's high in the polls. In 3.5 years' time, he could be dead.
Well, he could, because there's a lot going on. You know, there's plenty of things to happen. You know, look how fast things are becoming in the global environment.
So really, it's becoming a spectacle, this, a sort of show, isn't it?
Well, it's always was.
Well, I mean, it always has been to a certain extent, but there's these massive fluctuations in people's political loyalties. Loads of policies being introduced by political parties who've taken power that were not even in their manifesto. It's almost like it's a chaotic situation. And actually, although the press like to talk about, oh, this and this and this, they have absolutely no idea where we're going to be in 3.5 years' time at all.
No, because we don't really know what we're going to be in 3.5 weeks. That's how dangerous this situation is.
But they do predict it, and I quite like it when they do, I must say. But you know, we have to understand that anything could happen in 3.5 years' time. But Sky did this report a couple of weeks ago when the YouGov survey was out, which showed that Jeremy Corbyn, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Nigel Farage is almost certainly going to be the next Prime Minister if we have a general election tomorrow.
Now, they deny it at the moment, but quite frankly, the most likely outcome is that the Tories end up voting with Reform UK to put a Reform UK leader, Nigel Farage, in Downing Street. There are alternatives. The Tories could abstain, but Reform UK actually would still then have the most votes to put Nigel Farage in number 10, even under that. It's only if all of the parties, including the Tories, apart from Reform UK, voted together. And also, you had the Northern Ireland parties that aren't in this poll taking them over the winning line, that you'll get somebody other than Nigel Farage in Downing Street. But can you really see the Tories doing that en masse? It's hard to see. Right, now, look at who gets whacked under this poll. Here we've got the Labour faces. And look, Yvette Cooper, Wes Streeting, former leader Ed Miliband, deputy leadership contender Bridget Phillipson, former leadership contender Lisa Nandy, ex-deputy leader Angela Rayner, all gone under this polling projection. And lots of prominent Tories too, Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride, Robert Jenrick, there, Priti Patel, you've got Stuart Andrew, James Cleverly over here, Rick Holden, who was one time Tory party chairman, so many would be gone. Now, I want you to focus on a couple of things. Here is Reform's 311 seats, but where have they all come from? Well, look at this. 231 of them have come from Labour. That's where the seats are from for Reform UK under this. 71 from the Tories, 5 seats Reform hold on to, and the Liberal Democrats supply 2.
So there's the, I mean, we covered that a couple of weeks ago, that poll, but what do you make of it, Matt? It looks as if there's no stopping Farage and Reform now.
No, I'm actually very hopeful that the Left, your party and the Greens can win it, but it's going to take effort from everyone that actually cares, you know, helping it happen, volunteering, door knocking, whatever it's going to take. But I think it's crucial. I think we're at such a crucial moment in the world, in history, technologically, in terms of foreign policy and war and everything else, surveillance, that we need a win. And yeah, it's not Farage. And I think your party and the Greens are offering actual, really helpful change. And we need to make it happen. It can be no, like, sitting back and being cynical.
Our very own David Miller from Bristol here is saying that your party is dead in the water before it's even really got going, because it seems to have these basically deep-rooted divisions between Corbyn and Zara Sultana, which are making it very difficult for it to do anything, really. And, of course, there's no way... I mean, this is the same sorts of problems. Well, don't you? Go on, then.
Yeah, I mean, I understand it. It's certainly a bummer that it's had this rift happen and publicly... But I think they'll get over. I think they can totally be gotten over. People will forget. You know, people are not going to be remembering that in 3 years. So yeah, and they do seem to be moving forwards. I think. I mean, I tend to agree with what we know. Zara's position was, I think, was to try to make sure that the funding, the money, the party money, was not to be controlled by this little cabal on the inside. She wanted it to be really radically diplomatic. democratic and have all the members be able to vote on how the money is spent. I agree with that. I'm like, let's go with that.
But when she says if you're not pro-trans, you're not welcome in the Labour Party, she's actually cutting out probably, 80% of potential voters.
I guess that depends what she means by pro-trans. But, I think she's...
very helpful, is it? Anyway.
I think Corbyn is obviously key to that party's success. But I also think that we do need some fresh ideas about how to do politics, and Zara is on the cutting edge of that.
You like the Greens?
I prefer the Your Party, but I'm also really liking some of the things the Greens are doing.
Let me just lay this one on you, because Zach Polanski, the new leader, has apologised for claiming to be able to help women increase the size of their breasts using his mind. Maybe he was on these psychedelic drugs at the time. The newly elected Green Party leader, while previously working as a hypnotherapist, offered a session to increase an undercover newspaper reporter's breasts and improve her body image. He asked about the claims following his landslide leadership win. Mr. Polanski said, "I apologised for that 12 years ago, before apologising again." Asked if voters can trust him in light of the claim, he told the BBC Breakfast, "Well, it's never for a politician to say, trust me. But what I would say is I apologise. Well, I apologised for that 12 years ago, and one of my favourite politicians, Tony Benn, often said, I don't care where you came from, I care where you're going," which is an interesting way of putting it. But hypnotherapist, Martin, I can increase your breast size by my mind. This is not a very ethical way to make money, is it?
Well, the fact is that those who don't like him have gone back through his social media feed or whatever, because he's the coming force.
Well, no, please, just address that claim. I mean, it's a very bizarre thing to say, isn't it? It's not, most people wouldn't say, as a sort of an advertising or chat-up line, "I can increase your breast size with my mind."
Yeah, but bizarre. Have you ever seen The Spark?
He's not into women, by the way.
No, he's a bit. That's right. He's of course, homosexual.
Yeah.
Well, have you ever seen The Spark, Tony? It's a free magazine produced in Bath and Bristol. It's been going for years, and loads and loads
of adverts. Lots of adverts like that in there,
do they? Loads of adverts.
So it's those Green Party voters, aren't they?
Those are the potential Green Party voters. They believe in astrology.
True.
Some of them take psychedelic drugs. They do yoga. Yeah, voters.
Yoga is not the same as this hypnotherapy stuff, is it?
But people got into yoga initially in the 60s because it was a way of getting high other than taking drugs. There's a whole culture around it. Okay? Now that's where the Green Party's vote is. They're not trying to persuade people. These people are not getting fed up about immigrants.
So they're kind of old
the
hippies and their kids, basically.
That's right, yeah. But it's a definite... If there was a PR system, they could just organise that group and that would be fine. The problem we've got on the first past the post, and I'm not quite sure that Nigel Farage is in favour of proportional representation now, because they've got a chance to win under first past the post, they just might say, well, let's stick with the old system, which we've always had, which always put posh people like me in charge. So let's stick with that. I bet you that's what they're going to do if they did win. They're not necessarily going to
put money on it.
We will see. I don't think they are going to win for various reasons.
I think it's a worry. Of course, I was worried when I saw that Polanski had done that at any time of his life, thought that that was a viable therapy to promote. It makes me question his critical thinking. But, you know, we can all learn and grow. And this is 12 years ago. He does everything else I've heard him speak on so far. It seems prescient and you know, in line with what I think mostly needs to happen.
Maybe he'll be Britain's first gay prime minister.
I mean, that would be wonderful.
He's not going to be the prime minister under any circumstances, is he?
Well, I don't know.
I wouldn't say absolutely not.
Well, look, who knows what's going to happen in 3.5 years' time?
What's going to happen in next May is we're going to have elections.
Local elections. The Greens have been doing rather well here in Britain,
also,
haven't they?
Yeah, but also in Scotland and Wales, we're going to have elections to the Senate and to the Scottish Parliament. Now, that looks... Reform are going to do reasonably well in both elections because it's a proportional election. But they will not be forming any government because the left-wing parties in Scotland and Wales are stronger, and because it's a PR system, they will just block them out. That's all that will happen. The SNP are going to win, clearly going to win in Scotland, and Plaid Cymru look as if they're going to win in Wales, which is the first time they've ever done that. But of course, Reform will do well in both of those countries because it's a PR system.
I don't know about Plaid in Wales. I mean, we shall see. Anyway, look.
Well, they're heading opinion polls at the moment.
Just
Tony,
to finish off the chit chat about politics, UK politics, having a sort of good old look around at the end of the party conference season. The national debt is really in a terrible state, the money system. Martin, you pointed out to me something I had no idea, that in 2019 there was a financial crisis going on behind the scenes, which is very similar to the 2008 bailouts. And actually some banks were bailed out in 2019. So what's going on here is that governments are being, particularly the British government here, the Treasury, are being increasingly indebted to the private banking system to such an extent that there is no money in local authorities now to paint white lines on the road. There might be a little bit here and there to do it on a motorway so that the motorway isn't just tarmac with no lines on it. And so the basic public services that we're paying for through our national and our local taxes are not being delivered. We're being told here in Bristol that we're going to have 3 weekly bin collections. There's a story, I think it was in the Bristolian, actually, in the latest Bristolian here. We've got a copy of it on the table. A very good website it is too. It's bristolian.net. You can find it online. But we are privileged to have the actual paper here. What they're saying is that the local city council, for its budget, has already slated a big cut in the bin services, the money for the waste collection and recycling services, which means that the consultation they're holding on whether to reduce the bin collections from every 2 weeks to every 3 weeks is actually a foregone conclusion. They're going to do that. So can you say something about the national debt and why it matters and if it matters? Because it's the financial position of Britain is really it's like many individuals. They're just working on credit cards. The country is in massive debt now, trillions of debt.
Yeah, well, of course, that was the whole argument that Osborne made when he was the Chancellor. We've got this massive debt, which, of course, was simply through bailing the banks out. If you followed a free market philosophy like the von Mises Institute, you just let banks go bankrupt. Yeah, that's what they should do with Thames Water. Just let it go bankrupt. Now, if you let it go bankrupt, that means that only people who've got money in the banks, less than the insurance level, they will have their, that's what most people, will have their savings protected. But people like Nigel Farage, for example, who used to have a Coutts bank account, they have to lose all their money. Coutts goes down and Nigel has to lose all of his money and start at the bottom again. That is free market capitalism. If the banks are bust, let them go down. And that means that the wealthy classes who own the banks and who's got their money in the banks, they have to lose their money.
Okay, so the national debt...
We didn't do the that. National we bailed debt, it out. And that's why the national debt is going up through the roof. Because we bailed them out. We shouldn't have done it.
The national debt is now around about £2.7 trillion. Over the last year, since the general election, it's gone up roughly £200 billion, so that's from about 2.5 to 2.7 trillion. I'll just put a link up on our show page to a way of keeping track of these amounts, but this represents around about £6,500 increase in debt the government is in per household. So 6,000 debt they're holding for each household in Britain. I mean, this is a debt trap, isn't it?
I mean, this whole thing, the banking thing, is I need to do more, but I'm looking into it. But I definitely see crypto as one option out of it.
Well, isn't that the idea? Is that the banking system we've now got? Everyone says, "Oh no, that won't work." So crypto is there nicely ready for us.
Well, it depends, though.
But actually, that could be worse.
No, it depends, though, if it's controlled by an authority or if it's a public blockchain. If it's a public blockchain, no one controls it, and there's no middleman. There's no, you don't need a system around it. You don't need it just does what it does.
Surely the idea is what should happen is this debt should be just wiped out, and all those people that have been lending the money should just lose it. What would happen then, Martin?
Well, I think that is basically correct. I mean, you're trying to reduce the debt by cutting public expenditure, doesn't work. That's exactly what Osborne did. He cut public expenditure, and of course the economy started to go down, and the deficit increased. That is the Keynesian view of how the economy works. Now, Farage and the right wing, they don't accept that. They've got a very simplistic view of this. If we've got too much money that we owe, we've got to pay it back. Now, in actual fact, you don't have to pay it back. We could just bankrupt the wealthy. Because if you've invested in something like AI, there's a massive big
This is the problem. Is that the people who've got their money invested in banks don't want those banks to collapse. We're talking about millions and billions of company and individual money in those banks. Now, in a way, the rich and the big businesses, those are the ones we want to collapse.
Well, that's right. That's what should have happened in 2008. In 2008, when the banking system
collapsed,
give the
small businesses a break.
Yes, you could have let it collapse, but then we would have had to nationalise the banking system, and it would have been a complete change of direction for the whole
economy. All I'm saying is, when this sort of thing happens the next time, let's just let it all collapse. Let's let all those corporations lose their money. Let's let all those banks collapse. Let's let all those super rich people lose their money. All right.
The reason why they didn't do that is because you probably have to go through a social upheaval. Yeah,
I suppose it's the rich lobbying to make sure it doesn't happen.
The rich are lobbying, obviously. So we spend a lot of time talking about what we can afford. In actual fact, it's what they can afford. Yeah. I mean, the wealthy have made out like bandits during both the 2008 crisis and COVID.
The most amazing thing in this whole situation, Martin, the most amazing thing in this whole situation is that many of these super rich, and we're talking about like 1% of the population with masses and masses, so 80, 90% of the wealth or whatever. If they were to lose half their wealth, they wouldn't even notice it.
Mm.
Well, they would.
No, they wouldn't.
But in their lifestyle, they wouldn't notice it.
No,
they wouldn't, but they don't care about that. It's also,
they wouldn't have to sell the yacht. They might have to sell one of their five houses.
Well, one of the things that happened in Russia, of course, when the sanctions were put on Russia after 2022, is all of the Russian oligarchs had all their yachts seized in the West. And Putin went on TV in Russia and he said...
And mansions as well.
And he went on TV and in Russia and he said, if you think people in Russia are unhappy to see the yachts of the wealthy from Russia being seized in the West, you'd be completely wrong. We're cheering you on.
Anyway, look, I wanted to talk a bit, a final thing on politics, because I do like to look at this, as you can tell, this week, when we've had all these party conferences. Mel Stride, I think the guy's name is. Is it Mel Stride? Shadow Chancellor? Do you know who
he is? He's the Shadow Chancellor for the Tory
party. Sorry, I'm wrong. It's Sir Mel Stride. He's been made a Lord by Tampon Charlie. Obviously, one of Tampon Charlie's favourite people in the whole country. So let's have a listen to a little clip from his speech about the national debt and the economy.
Thanks to Labour, our national debt is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Debt is set to rise every single year until it is the size of the entire economy. The interest bill this year alone amounts to £6,000 for every working household in the country. And Labour's profligacy means our borrowing costs are now higher than Greece. Lower growth and higher debt sees us weaker and increasingly vulnerable. That is not just irresponsible, it is dangerous. And look at reform. They are just as bad. Reform's manifesto promised tens of billions in unfunded commitments. They want to scrap the two-child benefit cap, spending billions more on welfare. And they want you to pay for it. We say that if you want to fund a large family, then that's great. But you should look to yourself to pay, not the state.
Okay, so that's Sir Mel Stride, bless him. Has he got any solutions there? He's saying similar things to what I'm saying about the national debt. Does it really matter, Martin?
It does matter, but you can't easily solve the problem. It's like having cancer. You say, well, you know, we'll just eat carrots and it'll go away. It's not the case. You know, once you've gotten into a situation, and Britain isn't the only country, Japan's got an even worse situation with their debt and all the rest.
The US as well.
And the US, of course.
Of course, this is the politics then is in hock to the bankers, isn't it?
Well, that's right. That's exactly where we've ended up. And of course, what you could have done is followed a free market policy of letting the banks go down, which would have led to socialism anyway, because you then have to nationalise the banks. Or you stop talking in this. You see what he's doing there. The Tories are differentiating themselves from reform, because reform, because they're populists, are saying we're going to get rid of the two-child benefit cap. That's one of the reasons why Starmer's opinion poll ratings went through the floor. I'm a member of the Labour Party. I voted Labour in the election. And of course, what we wanted to see was, because the two-child benefit cap means that the poorest families with large, if you grow up in that family, it's, you know, a third and fourth child doesn't get any treats or whatever. And that this is what's the main cause of poverty. Now, of course, what the Tories are saying is we're not going to do that because it's just poor people and, you know, they should just, you know, go to the workhouse or die. But of course, reform and like Trump are trying to say, no, no, we're going to look after you. And then, of course, the Tories are going to say, well, how are you going to balance the books? And of course, Farage hasn't got an answer to balancing the books. He's just making promises. Now, of course, we shouldn't just make promises, but we don't have to. The national debt is not the end of the world. Britain has had a national debt since the Napoleonic Wars. We've never paid it back. And of course, during the second, at the end of the Second World War, we were massively in debt, but we could still afford to have a national health service, fight in Korea, and build a whole new generation.
Okay, so why doesn't the Treasury say to the Bank of England, right, just print a load of money and pay that debt off?
Because they don't do that, because that's not in the textbook, but it could be in a different textbook.
Yeah, it could.
And of course, what will happen as we go into this mega, mega international global crisis?
Would it probably devalue the currency?
Well, what's going to happen is there's going to be a huge economic crisis, and on the other side of that, there may well be a sensible socialist system, or we may all be dead.
Oh, thank you very much. Right, so that's it for the politics for now. But of course, there are also, I'd like to run through a few stories which we don't have specifically audio for, but interesting stuff nevertheless. Bristol City Council's been hit with a second enforcement notice after concerns about its secrecy. Now, this is something which, when we had Joe Banks on a couple of months ago, he was talking about this a lot and explaining that the council is got the worst record in the country for responding to freedom of information requests and is being investigated by the information commissioner. That's in Bristol Live. And Bristol City Council's hit with the second enforcement notice. This is the second time a regulator's recently ordered the council to improve its transparency. The information commissioner's office has ordered the council to get better at responding to subject access requests. So anybody has the legal right to ask a public organisation, such as a council, to send them information that they hold about them. While responding to these requests is onerous, public organisations have to respond by law in a similar way to freedom of information requests. So not only the FOIs not being responded to by the council, it's also the subject access request. So they're just not obeying the law, Matt.
Okay. Yeah. Well, freedom of information is where it's at. I don't have knowledge of that exactly, but the whole concept, you know, it is everything. Freedom of speech. That's why I fought for Assange so much. It is the key to everything. Once you leave freedom of speech, every other freedom disappears shortly after that. And I have just been reading this wonderful tweet from Pavel Durov, the founder of Telegram.
Yeah, Telegram guy, yeah.
He seems to be a mensch. You know, he's faced all sorts of pressures and he hasn't seemed to buckle.
Yeah, he was arrested by the French, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And then released. Now, yeah. The French want access to his Telegram network so they can read the tweet, you know, the messages in there. So the idea is, you know, these things are successful because they're private and then the owner gets stuck in a prison cell with a gun pointed to his head, said, look, you're going to have to let us into this thing, otherwise we're going to keep you in jail.
Yeah, and he said no. He says, his birthday today, he says, I'm turning 41, but I don't feel like celebrating. Our generation is running out of time to save the free internet built for us by our fathers. What was once the promise of the free exchange of information is being turned into the ultimate tool of control. Once free countries are introducing dystopian measures such as digital IDs, UK, online age checks, Australia, and mass scanning of private messages, the EU. That's a real worry, that one. Germany is persecuting anyone who dares criticise the officials on the internet. UK is imprisoning thousands for their tweets. France is criminally investigating tech leaders who defend freedom and privacy. A dark dystopian world is approaching fast while we're asleep. Our generation risks going down in history as the last one that had freedoms and allowed them to be taken away. So there's a little bit more, but that's
good old Pat. Well, thanks ever so much. That's absolutely relevant, isn't it? Particularly when the people who are supposed to be giving us the information that we need are just simply not doing it. I mean, this. I'm talking here about the London media, which I used to work in. You know, with the sorts of outlets that have got millions of listeners. And Martin, this last week, this synagogue attack, I mean, we did talk about it quite a lot last week, but first of all, amazing and horrifying to hear the BBC just lying about what had happened, saying that the attacker had killed two people. Well, no, the police killed one of the people and injured another. So actually, the police were ahead of the attacker on casualties, but they didn't say that. And in fact, even on Monday, I was watching the TV, and the BBC news people were repeating the lie that the attacker had killed two people. He hadn't. So also, maybe we should say something a bit about the failures of the police. I mean, this is unbelievable, isn't it? The idea that you will get professional firearms officers turn up and start shooting away with a door behind them and buildings behind them, which where people are then killed by their bullets. I mean, this is a basic thing. It's like, if you imagine something going on near a playground, if you're a police officer with a gun, are you going to open up on somebody with a whole bunch of kids in a playground behind them?
Are the kids Hamas?
Well, you know, that's a good... I mean, it's very unprofessional, is what I'm trying to say, and none of this has really come out.
I imagine that there will be an investigation by the police into what went on there, because they would...
the police will be investigating themselves. The IOPC have an absolutely diabolical record.
Yes. All that's true. Obviously, the media have basically jumped on this. I mean, you know, they tried to stop students this Wednesday in universities protesting about the genocide, and the Home Secretary saying and Starmer saying it's un-British. Listen, we've been putting up with hundreds of people dying every day in Gaza. Yeah, these are two people, and of course it's a terrible, terrible thing to have happened. Nobody's in favour of this apart from the crazy people.
It's actually one person.
Well, indeed.
Killed by an attacker. Yes. The other person killed by incompetent police.
Yes, all right. And of course last week we discussed whether it was a false flag or not. I'm looking at it now, Tony.
We don't know.
Yeah. Or let's just leave it at that for now.
Okay. I'd say, arguably, maybe Starmer's right. It is un-British, arguably, to protest against genocide. I mean,
that's right, yes, because
it's one of the most British things, isn't it?
I never saw William Pitt the Younger protesting against genocide when he was massacring Native Americans.
That's what when I think of Britain. Oasis, Monty Python, and genocide.
The Bengal famine in the 1940s killed millions.
Also, this is what I mean about the media, the mainstream media, and the way they are so absolutely treacherous, is the unreporting, the non-reporting of attacks on mosques and burning of mosques this week. I think it was in Bournemouth somewhere down that way.
Peacehaven.
There was a car bomb outside the Peacehaven Mosque.
Oh, I see.
It was a car bomb tempted arson.
Yeah, well, a car was set on fire, the idea being... Anyway, more importantly, Sheikh Mohammed Yusuf, he was from Al-Furqan Mosque in Hounslow, West London, he was stabbed about a week before the synagogue, and there was no reporting of it at all. Not even the local papers reported the stabbing, and he was hospitalised after having been stabbed. So there is a complete and utter, it seems to me, bias in the reporting of attacks on Muslims, fatal attacks on Muslims, serious injuries of Muslims, and on Jewish worshippers. And this attack on the synagogue, of course it's horrific, but it's biased, isn't it? It just seems to me very, very biased, the whole thing. It's like, this is the home front of the genocide over in Gaza.
Yeah, yeah, totally agree. It's absolutely sowing racist mentalities, as you say.
It's almost like Tommy Robinson is the news editor.
Yeah, and they're colonial genocides, aren't they? And it's the Greater Israel project, they do the same in many areas too. There's the way that they spun the people in boats coming over, refugees coming over. Suddenly that amped up. I'm sure everyone noticed the rhetoric around that got really big over the last few months. And then suddenly, that's the key to unlock the door to digital ID rollout. That well, was anyway, the button they I pressed.
I suppose what I'm saying is, I love you quoting Pavel Durov, because these people understand. Mm. Listen, we've created this thing, which is a tool for people to be able to communicate with. And what's happening is, as this is being rolled out, it's also being incorporated by the World Economic Forum, by by the Israel lobby, by all the usual suspects are just buying up the opposition. And this is what they see. This seems to be part of their game plan, Martin, is the genocidaires, anybody that shouts, "You're a genocidaire," is either shut down, shot, or bought up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the internet was originally created effectively by the US deep state. A lot of these internet startups in Silicon Valley were funded by DARPA, yeah. And of course, what they wanted to do is create an infrastructure where people would, get this new technology and think, wow, this is amazing. And once you've got them all hooked on it, you can then watch them, manipulate them, do all sorts of things with them. And of course, if you don't want to be watched, you have to get off the electronics altogether.
That's not, just a minute, because we've got a news story this week. Drones to be deployed all over Somerset to collect data. Somerset has been chosen to pioneer a major drones project. The council has been awarded funding from Innovate UK to help bring forward a project that could transform disaster response and environmental protection in the county. The award for about £200,000 comes from the Future Flight Regional Demonstration Fund for the council's Project Rescue that would investigate the potential for drones to be deployed to monitor emergencies. Well, this is great, isn't it? So you're going to see these drones buzzing around. I always remember this line in the Book of Revelation about locusts. So the Apostle John, as he's looking at this vision, he's saying, "What the hell are those things? They look like locusts." This, it seems to me, is these autonomous drones are being brought in everywhere and anywhere. But anyway, what do you think, Martin, about this, just deploying drones all over Somerset? Every time there's an excuse, off they go.
Well, obviously, this technology has got all sorts of potential positive uses and all sorts of potential negative uses. And the main problem with it is it revolutionises the production system, but that doesn't necessarily lead... I mean, the AI bubble is a bubble. I've been reading about this all week. The Bank of England, the IMF, they're all saying it's a bubble. And the people who are in the bubble know it's a bubble, but you've got this, what they call, fear of missing out. FOMO, fear of missing out. So everybody, it's rational to stay investing in AI until the bubble bursts. And what usually happens with these bubbles in history is they have a very, very, at the last minute, you can make a load of money in the last minute with the very last bit of the bubble, but as long as you get out in time, you'll be all right. And of course, everybody thinks they're going to be the ones
to
get out in time.
You can make a lot of money by saying, look, I can do this, please invest in me.
That's right.
And even whether you can or not.
Well, they've not made any, there's no evidence that they've got any kind of serious revenue streams, let alone profits.
We've got all sorts of new bubbles that might appear. One of them is scientists making a huge breakthrough as babies can be born without biological mothers. Isn't that wonderful? Scientists have created human eggs from skin cells for the first time this week. We hear babies can be born without biological mothers. After scientists make a huge step forward in helping infertile people have babies. Of course, that's what it's all about, is it? Scientists revealed yesterday they have turned human skin cells into eggs and fertilised them with sperm in the lab for the first time. Who needs love? Who needs family? Who needs humans? American experts from Oregon Health and Science University say the human eggs made from skin cells are ready for fertilisation. When the team fertilised the egg with the sperm, it began growing into an embryo until the experiment was halted at 6 days, the point at which an embryo would be transferred to the womb in IVF. The breakthrough would allow older women struggling to conceive or women who lack eggs for medical reasons to have a baby. So they come along, scrape off a bit of your skin, stick it in a test tube, add a bit of sperm. 6 days later, in it goes.
Yeah, that's...
This is a great new technology, and loads of money could be made doing this.
Yeah, I don't know. Like Martin said, there's a positive and a negative, depending on how you use technology and in which situation.
You don't need mums anymore.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, we already don't need fathers, and that's had no negative consequences on society at all. The studies showing how, you know, fatherless families, the children end up, all the metrics for a life go down, you know, if you don't have a father. Apparently it's not the same if you don't have a mother, like a single parent household with a father. The metrics, they're not really altered. But I'm not saying we don't need mothers. I'm saying we do need to start, I don't know, looking at the issue of fathers and how they're getting cut out. You know, I've certainly had experience of that myself.
Isn't this most of this? Isn't this most of this a result of the liberal society of the 1960s, the pill and all this, this free love, this idea of free love? Oh, you can just kind of shack up with anyone and then just move on.
Well, obviously, that's certainly an element in this. But if you actually ask people, I mean, my other half's 73, and if you ask it, would you want to go back to the 1950s, where all of these things were swept under the carpet and everybody was, you know, much more tight-laced than they are now? And the answer is no.
Well, no.
People prefer the choice.
Okay, the 1950s was about more to do with no sex before marriage. Simple as that, wasn't it? There was a whole sort of courtship thing that you would decide on someone for life.
Yes, okay, but I mean, the point is that the society has changed in a permissive way, but this stuff isn't really to do with the permissive society. This is corporate production of people.
They're cashing in on it, aren't they?
Brave New World came out when? In the 1960s, didn't it? And that was written in the 1960s about a kind of future dystopia.
I think 50s, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, okay, but the point is that Aldous Huxley's vision of the future is closer than 1984, actually. 1984, which is everybody's heard of, the use of technology in Brave New World is far more similar to what we're going through than 1984, which was essentially a pastiche version of the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union's dead. But Brave New World is still very much with us.
Well, the Police Service of Northern Ireland, you've been mentioning this over the last few weeks, Martin, have not been arresting people saying that they support Palestine Action, which is fascinating, that they understand, look, this is just a problem we do not need. And but last weekend, they were brought over to London, last Saturday, in fact. The PSNI popped up in Trafalgar Square, and they were being told, you're going to have to arrest all these people who are holding up signs saying, I support Palestine Action, I am against genocide, or whatever it is exactly those signs say. So isn't it? I find fascinating that the PSNI, it's almost like they've got to be blooded in on this absurd law.
Well, that's right. That's right. That's exactly what's happened. And presumably the PSNI have taken the view that in Northern Ireland, you know, we're not going to arrest people for holding a sign up. I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, what happened is at one stage was the loyalists who'd been burning people out of their houses in County Antrim. They had a big bonfire with a boat on it with people with black faces in it being burned and stopped the boats and all. But they didn't arrest anybody there either, because the general philosophy in Northern Ireland is people are going to have these views. We can't just arrest them for having their views.
Because really
we have to arrest everybody.
Isn't
and
what's
we can't
going
be
on here is there is an attempt to actually get civil unrest going in Britain. The PSNI are wise to that.
Well, I think what's going to happen is look what Elon Musk said to Tommy Robinson's rally the other week. He said, you may not want violence, but violence is coming to you, and it's time to fight or die. Now, he's the richest man in the world, a white South African.
Second,
and he's
richest.
Well, yes, apparently not now.
Oh, okay, yeah, keep it goes moving. Up and down week
goes
by week.
Goes up and down week by week. But, I mean, that is absolutely outrageous. This is a foreign billionaire trying to say to people in Britain that you're going to have to physically fight. I would say, well, actually, I agree with Ellen. We are going to have to physically fight. There is going to be a civil war. We've had one already. And, of course, two Tory prime ministers were nearly murdered in that civil war, and then we fixed it. Would Ellen like to live in a country where you could end up being murdered, mate? Is that what you want? Is that what you're looking for? Because it doesn't matter how rich you are, you still die, you still bleed.
Finally, before the break, a quick look at Ukraine. Hungary's Viktor Orban was at the Copenhagen summit last week. Sorry, I missed this from last week's. He says the European Union has decided to go to war with Russia. He says we're having nothing to do with it. And he's almost like a kind of whistleblower in these EU meetings. He's saying that's what they've decided to do, Martin, that actually the Germans and the rest of the EU, they actually want to have a war with Russia. Are these people mad?
Well,
or is he deluded?
Well, no, he's right that they're talking up a war with Russia. They can't have one because they can't do it. I mean, well, the Russians roll their eyes.
What he's saying from the meeting is they are now planning for it. They have now, the budgets have already been allocated. Yes. They are now, things, the wheels are starting to turn. And
they can spend a lot of money on it.
They're getting detailed plans ready. They're also manufacturing the things they need to fight Russia with. The Germans, by the way, I just saw this one, I think it's from a couple of months ago, but they've the Germany's Merz has vowed now to build Europe's strongest army. Our friends and partners also expect this from us, and what's more, they're actually demanding it from us, said the new Chancellor. So if with Germany, people seem to be sort of not aware. Germany's fought two world wars, and they're now saying we want to be the most powerful army in Europe again.
Well, they're saying it, and they shouldn't be saying it for all the reasons
you're saying. And their fingers are pointing, and their guns are pointing at Russia.
Yes. The thing is, the Russians are aware of all of this. Of course they are. I mean, they wanted to be, they wanted to have a reasonable, responsible relationship with the EU, but they've given up on it. They're not scared. Can you imagine? The Russian army is now the best in the world. At the end of 3 years of fighting, they've lost 100,000 guys, but they're absolutely at the top of their game. And if we sent the whole British army tomorrow to the Ukraine, they'd last 2 weeks. 70,000, they'd be dead.
A mad story yesterday. Zelensky says he's going to nominate Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize if he sends Tomahawk missiles to him. You couldn't make it up, could you?
Well, he can't do it now because, somebody else has got it.
So that does prove cocaine is a hell of a drug.
And Russia's momentum to... Russians are saying, okay, finally, before the break, the Russians are saying the momentum to peace has been largely exhausted.
That's right. I mean, Trump wanted to have an easy win there where he could just say, hey, I've signed this all off and Putin's just going to do what I want. Putin's perfectly happy to... the Russians have said all along, we'll talk to you. We've been saying, talk to us. And everybody said, we're not talking to you. You're a dictator, you're this, that and the other. So Trump broke that. But of course, he then thought that Putin was just going to sign on the dotted line for what Trump wanted. And Putin is an elected leader. He can't just sign away the country's national interests to give Trump a PR win. So he didn't. And he obviously did his very best. Unlike Trump, Putin has got absolutely excellent manners. You know,
so if Donald Trump doesn't win, and he hasn't won, is it possible he'll just start a war tomorrow with Venezuela?
Well, that's what it's looking like. They look as if they want a war with Venezuela because they think they're a small fry and they can slap them around. Which, of course, is why the Norwegian Nobel Prize Committee has given this thing to Machado, because that's a way of keeping Trump off their back. Because what they thought is, if we don't give it to Trump and we give it to somebody else, Trump could put sanctions on us. Yeah, he could do all sorts of nasty things to us. You know, he put 50% extra sanctions on Brazil because he didn't like Lula and he wanted him to drop the case against Bolsonaro. So it's not a question. I mean, Trump is just, he's one of those kind of emperors that you've got to be very careful, you know, like Caligula.
Should have given him the peace prize so they avoid this
war. You're going to regret not giving me that peace prize.
Anyway, we'll be looking at this ?, ceasefire, peace deal after the break.
Next up on Theme Time Radio Hour, we want to visit the rivers of Babylon, as sung about by the Melodians, a vocal trio who are considered one of Jamaica's greatest rock steady groups. In this song, they talk about the rivers of Babylon. The song Rivers of Babylon is based on the biblical hymn Psalm 137 that expresses the yearnings of the Jewish people in exile following the conquest of Jerusalem in 586 BC. The Melodians version, on the other hand, is from 1969 AD.
By the rivers of Babylon, how can we sing King Alpha's song in our strength?
was The Rivers of Babylon by the Melodians. The Rivers of Babylon are considered the Euphrates River, its tributaries, and the Sheba River. The name Babylon comes from Babalu, which means the gate of God. It is an ancient city on the Euphrates River, about 50 miles south of modern Baghdad.
So that's the Wales. Actually, sorry to spoil it for you folks, but it wasn't actual recordings of Wales. It was the guitarist Dave Gilmour who came in after Syd Barrett left Pink Floyd and playing with his wah-wah pedal on it, but then reversing it. But it does sound very much like, if you listen to real recordings of Wales, a similar sort of sound. So that was Pink Floyd from the album Echoes, the album Medal, the track Echoes, which is, I think, most of the second side of it. And before that, what did we have? We had the Melodians and the Rivers of Babylon with Theme Time Radio Hour. And I think, because that's only halfway through, I think, because, you know, can't do the whole of Echoes because it's really long. But what we could maybe do is pick up the Wah Wah pedal or the Wales next week and play the second part of Echoes. That'd be nice, wouldn't it, if we can manage to do that. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist and me, Martin Summers. We're still, he's going to be dashing off in a minute, but Matt O'Brannan is still here. Matt, can you just give us your take then on whether this ceasefire deal with Trump is going to hold?
The million-dollar question. Obviously, yeah, there's a lot of reason to be cynical that it won't. I err towards that. I don't feel good about it. I don't have a good feeling about it. But another part of me is like, gosh, maybe Trump could actually do something useful for once and make this last. But of course, it's going to be on. They're going to try and make it on the terms of the West, and they want their canal, and they want their beachfront resorts and all the rest of it. Tony Blair. I don't know if whether the second phase, Martin. What do you think? You know, are Hamas really going to disarm? I mean, the idea that the Gaza is the one that has to disarm and not Israel, which is by far the aggressor, is obviously ridiculous. I mean, what about an idea where they both disarm? That could be interesting.
Well, I think what Hamas have done is that they could have just said, well, because the various ceasefires that they've agreed, they've just broken the terms of the ceasefire. So they'd be within their rights to say, well, we're not doing any deals with you because you don't stick to the ones you've already done. But I think they quite sensibly decided that wouldn't... their own people are suffering terribly, and they have got a duty to minimise that insofar as they can. Also, of course, they're under terrible pressure from everybody else, so please just stop making a fuss and so that we can all go back to sleep.
The whole point of the resistance and the attacks on the 7th of October 2023 is really disputed a lot, isn't it, of course, by people who are actually living in Gaza. I remember that documentary the BBC didn't want to show, the first scene in it, someone's cursing Hamas for starting it all. This is a Palestinian. So, you know, they're not all like that, I'm sure, but and also some of them are prepared to go, you know, to die.
Well, I think it's hard to say what people actually think who are there. And there's not only going to be one opinion, is there? What I feel has happened is that at first there were quite a lot of people. At first there was a lot of euphoria about it because it seemed to be quite a successful operation. And of course, previously the Israelis had taken the line: if you're holding Israeli hostages, then we will not do anything.
We're going to be talking about this in a minute, but Matt's just about to go. Before you do, Matt, can you just give us your socials and people are interested in following and finding you?
Yeah, very good. I have just legally changed my name in the last couple of weeks. Matt O'Brannon, reclaimed the Irish spelling. So it's Matt O'Brannain. So I'm on Twitter. I'm pretty active on there and Instagram. Occasionally on TikTok too. The wonderful Democratic
pipeline. Well, it is good. It is good for now. And it's been destroyed because it's so good.
That's right.
Matt, I'm going to call you Matt O'Brannain. Because it's just easier to know how to spell it. I know it's wrong, but there you go. Anyway, Matt, thanks ever so much for being with us again. We're going to hear now from Donald Trump. Well, actually, not from him, but his Truth Social post, which announced this ceasefire.
Let me just bring you some breaking news we've had in the last few minutes. On his Truth Social website, President Trump has posted that he's proud to announce that Israel and Hamas have both signed off on the first phase of our peace plan. The statement continues, "This means that all of the hostages will be released very soon and Israel will withdraw their troops to an agreed upon line as the the first steps towards a strong, durable and everlasting peace. All parties, he writes, will be treated fairly. This is a great day for the Arab and Muslim world, Israel and all surrounding nations, and the United States of America. And the president continues, we thank the mediators from Qatar, Egypt and Turkey who worked with us to make this historic and unprecedented event happen. Blessed are the peacemakers. So that is the latest post from President Trump just in the last few minutes, announcing that Israel and Hamas have both signed off on the first phase of our peace plan. And the president makes it clear that all of the hostages will be released very soon and Israel will withdraw their troops to an agreed upon line. Well, we've just had that statement in the last few minutes.
So Donald Trump is saying, Martin, that Bibi, you have no choice. That's his words, not in that particular tweet, but elsewhere. I mean, Israel and Hamas have agreed on the first phase of the Gaza peace plan, hailing it as historic and unprecedented. But that's a quote from Trump. Bibi, you have no choice. Well, does that mean Trump is really in charge of this process?
I think that there's obviously behind the scenes struggle between what Bibi wants and what Trump wants, and of course in many respects they're on the same page, but sometimes their personal interests don't entirely coincide. And of course you would expect that the US, being the superpower that provides all the money that makes Israel possible, because of course it's a massive welfare state funded by the US taxpayer, they're in a position to tell them things to do, otherwise we're going to cut off your pocket money. So he's always been in a position to do that. And of course JFK, before he was assassinated, probably by the Israelis, was taking a pretty tough line with them, because if you know, you're a tiny little country with a few million people and we're a superpower.
Antiwar.com is one of my favourites. They have amazing story that United States has spent over $31 billion aiding Israel in the last 2 years. So this is $15 billion a year. The United States is key to this genocide.
Absolutely. And of course, the lifestyle of middle-class Israelis depends upon US taxpayers. It always did. It's not actually a viable country. If it had to pay its way in the world, it couldn't. It's a good job the American taxpayers are so generous, eh?
The Cost of War project at Brown University, which the Israel lobby will now do everything they can to possibly can to close down, destroy, cancel, etc., has calculated that the total US military support to Israel over the past 2 years has cost US taxpayers over $30 billion. Israel received over $21 billion in military aid from the United States, and Washington has bombed Iran and Yemen for Tel Aviv. So that's a little bit extra too. According to the study, US provided Israel with tens of thousands of bombs and other weaponry following the Hamas attack on southern Israel 2 years ago. The American arms have fueled Israel's genocide in Gaza.
That's right. And they also, as I was hinting there earlier, they also fund the general existence of the Israeli state. I mean,
that's about $3 billion a year, isn't it?
That's just for the military stuff.
The $3 billion is for just the funding for the state. But what the Cost of War project is saying, that it's $31 billion over 2 years, about $15 billion a year for the war.
Yeah. And that's all, if you're working hard as a delivery driver in Chicago, your taxes are going to keep the Israelis in the style to which they've become accustomed and the bombs that they need. But you can't yourself find anywhere to live or get any healthcare.
Seems like this is maybe a cost-cutting measure, this peace deal by Trump.
Well, maybe so. I think Trump wanted to have, you know, because he's driven by headlines and ego, he wanted to have something that he could put his name to. But of course, the various phases, Hamas have agreed to the first phase, which is to release what the other side call hostages. I went to a vigil for Palestine earlier this week, and of course the Palestinians point out these are not hostages, they are prisoners of war. All the ones that they've got left there are military personnel. Yeah, they are soldiers. So they're being released, and of course some Palestinian prisoners are being released. 10,000 people are being held by the Israelis, mostly without charge or trial. Many of them have been brutally mistreated to the point of maiming and killing them.
Well, just before the ceasefire was announced, Channel 4 News did a fantastic report on the massive support that the Starmer government and Britain is giving for the Israelis too.
Exclusive analysis by our fact-check team shows Israel's arms imports from the UK have hit record-high values in recent months. This comes as the government is under increasing pressure to impose a full arms embargo. This data is from Israel's tax authority, showing the value of arms imports from the UK. Now, any company in the UK wanting to sell arms abroad has to apply for a licence. And in September last year, the government suspended 29 out of 350 licences to export arms to Israel, stopping, they say, any items used by the IDF in Gaza. But some arms sales did continue. And as we exclusively revealed last week, Israel said it received £408,000 worth of arms from the UK in June. And that was the highest monthly value since these customs records began back in January 2022. And we can now exclusively reveal that those high-value exports are continuing. September here was the second highest month on record, with £316,000 worth of arms from UK firms passing through Israeli customs. We don't know exactly what the items were or who their end user was, but they were listed under a category which includes bombs, missiles, and ammunition, as well as parts for these items. Now, despite suspending some licenses, by July this year, UK firms held 347 active licenses to export arms to Israel, 167 of which were explicitly military licenses. And some recent licenses that we've identified cover items like grenade launchers, parts for mortars, and parts for missiles. We asked the government what exactly was in the shipments we uncovered and who they were for, if not the IDF. It didn't provide any more detail on their contents, nor did the Israeli government, it said, for confidentiality reasons. The UK government told us, though, that we do not export bombs or ammunition for IDF use in military operations in Gaza or the West Bank. It said the data we've highlighted includes items which are for civilian use only or not staying in Israel. And it said that it has taken all possible steps to prevent licensing exports that could possibly be used by the IDF to perpetrate the ongoing horror in Gaza.
So well done, Channel 4 News. Good to see that. A little bit of primary research being done there. Brian O'Flynn, well, maybe we won't be seeing him on Channel 4 News. Maybe he'll be being cancelled at some point. But this is, it's not as big as the United States, but it's still an absolute scandal that something like £5 million is being spent every year on, or being made, actually. I think maybe that's just the turnover, the value of the goods. But £5 million worth of stuff going out to the genocidalists from the UK, and Starmer isn't stopping it. The other thing to say about all this, of course, is when an arms license isn't granted to a specific company, guess what happens? The company then sells its stuff to another company that then sells it to the Israelis, and it puts a little bit of profit on top of it.
Yeah, I mean,
or they go via Turkey or somewhere like that.
Well, we've been supplying weaponry to the Israeli state for many, many years. And, of course, at the Labour Party conference, Unison, my union, put forward a motion to put an arms embargo on Israel, which was passed by the conference. But, of course, it's going to be ignored by the government. This conference doesn't decide policy anymore. I mean, it used to have some influence on policy in the years gone by, but now it's just a bit of a talking shop.
Yeah, the point is that the British government is complicit in genocide. War criminals are doing this. War criminals are helping the Israelis.
That's right. But, of course, what they're going to do now with this ceasefire is they're going to say, well, that's all over now and we're all moving forward, so let's forget about that and let's move on.
It may be that some of these things, the pressure that's been being put on, are one of the reasons that the ceasefire has happened, just to sort of cool it off.
Well, I think it's quite clear that the massive response by civil society in the West means what's going on has put pressure on all governments. I mean, the Spanish government have, probably taken the strongest line. They're talking about, not just an arms embargo, but an economic boycott. And that's because there have been massive, massive protests in Spain, where something like 85% plus of the population are appalled by what's going on. But that's because they've got the history of the Spanish Civil War and all the rest of it, millions of people in Spain ended up dead in what was effectively a genocide in the 1940s and 1950s.
So from the flotilla people arrested, several were held, including Yvonne Ridley, who we know quite well on this programme as being one of the whistleblowers to do with the Iraq War. The whistleblower Catherine Gunn from GCHQ passed her information that the Americans were fixing the vote, or trying to, at the United Nations Security Council to do with the Iraq War, to an individual who passed it to Yvonne Ridley, who took it to The Observer. And eventually, after a couple of weeks, it appeared in The Observer, in which case Catherine says in the longer interview you will hear later, or which will be up on our show page later tonight, she was very nervous that the leak wouldn't appear, but then she was even more nervous when it did appear. So you can understand that. And there's a whole film about that, isn't there? Do you remember the name of the film?
Yeah, I can't remember. Some
Official Secrets, I think it's called. Yeah. Something very simple like that. Anyway, I'll look up the name of the film. But in the meantime, let's have a listen to Yvonne Ridley, because she was one of the people who were kidnapped by the Israelis from the flotilla and kept for a few days and then eventually released.
Salaam alaikum, everyone. This is Yvonne Ridley. Free! I just want to thank all of you, every single one of you, who campaigned, who prayed, who petitioned, who protested for the freedom of myself and my flotilla crew members. I just have a solid knot in my heart for the little girl from Gaza who was waiting on the beach every day saying that she was looking out for our sails. So sad for her and all the children in Gaza. That was the reason for our mission. Sorry we failed you. You know what? I think it was Nelson Mandela that said, no, look at your failures and it's how you pick yourself up afterwards. So guess what? We are already talking about sailing again. And come hella high water, we are going to sail into Gaza. Many of you who know me know that I spent 11 days in prison under the Taliban regime in 2001. Well, I'll tell you something now, and this is straight from the heart. I would rather spend 2 months in a Taliban prison than 2 days with the Israelis. Peace and love to everybody, and free, free Palestine.
I quite like the way she says peace and love. Anyway, that's Yvonne Ridley, now free. Martin, the flotilla was kind of knocked off the headlines by last week's synagogue attack, but it looks as if pretty much everybody has been... And actually, Yvonne Ridley was only released because the Scottish government started making a big fuss about it. It's like the Israelis only seem to care about what's going to get into the news and isn't. So they hung on. They thought, oh, no, let's stick Yvonne Ridley, everyone will forget about her, into a gulag. We'll use our control over the press, or our influence, the Israel lobby influence, to keep it out the news. And it wasn't really covered in the news at all until the Scottish government started saying, hang on, Yvonne is Scott. So what are you doing, Westminster? Why aren't you saying anything? Why aren't you doing anything? The next day, Yvonne Ridley was released.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the purpose of doing these things is to put pressure on the Israeli government and on Western governments that are complicit in the genocide. So, to that extent, it serves its purpose.
So, anyway, Catherine Gunn's film was 2019 film was called Official Secrets, and well, it's not her film, but it's a film about what happened to her. And it's absolutely brilliant film. If you've not seen it, I will put a link to it.
Is it Keira Knightley who plays it?
Yeah. And there's some lovely shots of her. Catherine went to the opening of the film as well. But it is just a cracking film. It's not advertised. It's sort of cancelled in a way. It's like, oh, it's difficult to find it on the search and this sort of thing. But if you've not seen it, please do. And I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which tells the whole story about Catherine Gunn and her successful attempt to get the Iraq War made illegal and to stop the Americans fixing the vote at the United Nations Security Council. Well done, Catherine. So we go, and as I said, we'll be hearing a bit from Catherine in a minute as well. But Double Down News did a brilliant, because a lot of this, Martin, is It's 2 years since this massacre started on October 7th, 2023. And there are quite a few people who are raising doubts about what actually really happened on October the 7th, 2023. So what are your thoughts on that before we hear from a former UN chief who was on Double Down News this week?
Well, I think it's pretty clear, and even the Israeli public opinion understands, that the Israeli intelligence services were well aware that something was going to happen. And in actual fact, they stood down. I was looking at something earlier where this Israeli soldier is testifying under oath to, in some inquiry in Israel, saying that we were told to go home, and not to, you know, we knew something was happening, but we were told to go home and let it happen. In other words,
Lie hop,
let it happen on purpose. So in other words, either the whole thing could have been aborted by the Israelis, you know, storming in and preventing it, or they could have responded quite quickly without overwhelming force.
I remember in October 23, we were hearing from the Egyptians, literally the day it happened, that, oh, well, we told the Israelis that something like this was about to happen. We'd seen, yeah, our intelligence people had picked up the plans for it about to happen.
That's right, and of course there were a load of female soldiers whose job was to just monitor things through CCTV, and they kept saying, well, they're obviously about to do something, and they were told that, don't worry about it, it'll be fine.
So there was a stand down of some sort. Charlie Kirk referred to this before he died.
That's right.
And what about the Hannibal directive?
Well, that's right. They're going on about how terrible it was that the Hamas killed 1,200 people on October the 7th, but a large proportion of them were killed deliberately by the Israeli security forces. A lot of the people who were at the Nova rave, they killed them with Apache helicopters and also with tanks in the kibbutzes. And all the evidence was coming out, but then we were just bombarded with a load of nonsense about how babies had been burned in ovens and all this stuff,
well,
which
is
total propaganda.
The couple of days after, there were phone-ins on the Israeli radio, and a lady phoned in who'd been in Kibbutz Berry. Now, that, since this has been attempted to be erased completely, but she was saying that we were pleading with the IDF not to fire. We were shouting out the window, but they killed everybody, all of our Jewish family in Kibbutz Berry, and I was one of the only survivors, and I was lucky to survive, but the tanks were actually firing tank rounds into the house with us in there.
That's right. So, in other words, what they didn't want, I mean, what Hamas presumed, because when they kidnapped Gilad Shalit, who was an Israeli soldier years ago, they were able to hold him for several years, and eventually were able to swap him for a quite substantial number of Palestinian prisoners. And back in that era, the Israeli society was very, very wary of the deaths of people from Israel, whether they were soldiers or civilians. So if you were holding hostages, they wouldn't do anything to try and, you know, free them by violence, because that would probably end up with them being dead. So what Hamas's calculation was, they're not going to attack us, they're going to negotiate with us. That's what they presumed would happen. But of course the Israelis had already decided that they weren't going to negotiate about anything. They killed as many people as possible to reduce the number of hostages that they'd have to negotiate about. And of course many of the hostages inside Gaza that had been held have been killed by Israeli airstrikes. They've killed their own hostages rather than negotiate.
Exactly. So to what extent do you think Hamas it was infiltrated by the Mossad, was a creature of Israel?
Well, it started off being created by Mossad as a way of undermining the PLO, but then it got a life of its own and it became an independent force. Of course, all intelligence services are going to be trying to infiltrate the other side of stuff.
But to what extent was Hamas infiltrated, and to what extent was it actually being steered by the Mossad?
I think what happened here is that Hamas had its own reasons for doing what it wanted, what it did, because that what was going to happen is Trump's Abraham Accords were going to Saudi Arabia and other countries were going to recognise Israel.
On, Trump wasn't around at the time, was he?
No, he was. It was the first term, Tony.
They didn't happen in Trump's first term, the 7th of October.
In his first term, he was in the business of You know, throwing me off my trail.
Sorry, you were just talking about the Abraham Accords.
The Abraham Accords, right. So in other words, what Yahya Sinwar and the Hamas realise that if they don't do something now, a deal is going to be done over our heads between the Saudis and the Israelis and all these other Egypt and so on.
Qatar.
And we will just be ignored. So if we don't do something now, we're just going to be written out of the script. And that's why they did it, because it was a last throw of the dice from the Palestinian resistance point of view.
Okay. Okay, well, let's have a listen now to the former UN chief on Double Down News talking about what really happened on the 7th of October.
What happened in October is that the Israelis got their talking points out brilliantly. And as someone who's done public communications, I can recognise. So the narrative went out, it was a surprise attack. There was no real context. There were Hamas butchers. They killed 1,400 people or 1,200. There was no context. Israel could do whatever it liked in order to implement its right of self-defense.
Israel has a right to defend itself.
Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself.
All of those talking points are wrong. There was a context, the context of 1948, the dispossession of the Palestinians, the context of 1967, the context of the occupation, 2007, the context of the blockade, and then all the conflicts that happened since then. The idea that Israel has the right of self-defense. According to the 2004 legal opinion of the ICJ, occupied people cannot be attacked. The occupying power has an obligation to protect them. And yet here was Israel destroying, blowing them up, doing all these terrible things to them. The idea that it was a butchery by Hamas. People don't report much on the Hannibal directive. And this is a directive that comes, it's an IDF directive that they put to their soldiers. Haaretz, the newspaper in Israel, has reported, has investigated this. There were at least three areas where the Hannibal directive was invoked. Helicopters came in and simply destroyed anyone that was trying to get back into Gaza. That included Israeli soldiers, Israeli hostages, and Hamas and others from Gaza. So there were charred bodies, cars completely blown to smithereens. We don't know how much of that was Hamas and how much of that was the Israeli army. We simply don't know. And yet we accept this narrative that there were these terrorists who came over and butchered 1,400 people. So, as I say, the Israeli talking points are either wrong or simply unsubstantiated. And yet that was the narrative which has taken hold.
I saw little kids who were beheaded. We didn't know which head belongs to which kid. We saw a little baby in an oven. These put these babies in an oven and put on the oven.
This idea that it started on October 7th, I first went to Gaza in 2006, and there was a blockade, a collective punishment.
The blockade of the Gaza Strip is creating an atmosphere of deprivation that can only deepen the sense of hopelessness and despair among people.
The whole blockade of Gaza and all the cruelty and economic stifling that we saw, all of that was part of a much bigger design, which ultimately is the determination by Israel that Palestine should not be a state, that Palestinians should not have the right to self-determination.
Our experience is that this radicalizes an already demoralized and isolated population, and the radicalization of Gaza does not serve the interests of peace.
In 2014, I was the UNRWA spokesperson when, during the war, actually, let me not call it a war, it isn't a war, you know, a war is between two opposing armies, and this is a group, 2.3 million people behind a fence who are completely defenseless. And yet we talk about Israel's right to self-defense. We don't talk about the right of self-defense of 2.3 million people who have absolutely nobody to defend them. And that's why actually it isn't a war. It's something else. It's a genocide, actually. So what happened was the Israelis hit a school and Al Jazeera Arabic called me up and wanted an interview. And the Israelis had hit one of our schools. Children had been killed. Their parents had been killed as they slept in the morning in an UNRWA facility. And, you know, they went to that facility thinking that they would have, I really can't talk about it. I really can't talk about it. It really triggers me. let me try and carry on. Can you edit this bit? It just triggers me. It really does.
The rights of Palestinians, even their children, are wholesale denied, and it's appalling. I think it really speaks to
Man's Inhumanity to Man, that in 2014 there were 530 odd children who were killed, and this was absolutely appalling. We have seen a school hit directly. Children sleeping next to their parents on the floor of a UN-designated safe area have been killed. It is an affront to the humanity of all of us. The world should hang its head in shame.
Did you tell them about the location of this school and how many people were inside?
17 times we called to give them the precise coordinates of this school and to inform them of the fact that 3,300 people had taken refuge there. So that is certainly not an excuse that can be given.
This is the second time this has happened with a large loss of life. How should the international community respond?
Well, we've made it quite clear that it's time for accountability. We've made it quite clear that those with the power to act should take deliberate political action. Though nothing happened in the way of sanctioning the Israelis. We've now moved to a point where at least 20,000 children have been killed. We don't know how many. And yet, again, there is absolutely no meaningful international reaction.
So that's Chris Gunness there. Quite an amazing little section there from an older interview, I think from about 10 years ago, where he was being interviewed on TV and he just broke down when he was the spokesman for the United Nations Special Coordinator for Middle East Peace Process. That's UNESCO. No, he was an UNRWA spokesperson. So I think fascinating to hear from someone who's been involved in this. Chris Gunness was at the BBC from the 1980s until 2005. He then went on to become spokesman for and director of communications UNRWA, which is the Palestinian mission of the United Nations relief mission. And he's on the press. He was in the media. Well, he's now on Double Down News, but he's explaining there. This is a massive history, and he's also untangling, I think, as journalists, good journalists will do, the way that this has been spun by the Israelis very successfully, a strategic communications and PR victory. They see the October 7th attacks in 2023 as a massive victory in PR.
Well, that's right, and they've tried to bend the minds, particularly of Western audiences, with a barrage of misinformation and disinformation. But the reality has got through because of because of things like TikTok and so on, which is why we're talking about earlier, the Zionist billionaires have taken over all of these social media companies which were allowing this kind of information to circulate. Because, of course, if we were relying just on mainstream media, as we used to have to do, people's knowledge of this would be extremely patchy. You know, they wouldn't know a fraction of what we do actually know now. And, of course, even the Israelis themselves have realised that they've got to do something about, social media users finding out stuff that they don't want them to know.
Well, the other thing, of course, is the number of journalists killed by the Israelis so far. A deadly toll on journalists. Five more Palestinian journalists had been killed a week before last, bringing the total number of journalists and media workers killed since October 2023 to at least 189. That's according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. And one of those journalists killed is a certain Wafa Aludaini, who we had on this programme. And it was just horrible to hear a year or so ago about her being killed with her whole family. She'd been reporting specially for this programme. She was particularly good as a journalist, I would say, just, without fear or favour, because she was, for example, Martin, one of the things she was doing, well, I don't know how much you remember, but there was an attack on a school, it was a hospital, and Israel immediately said, these are the Hamas operatives we killed in that hospital. Well, Wafa went through the list of names and she discovered that several of them were already dead and others weren't actually even in Gaza.
Well, that's right.
Pulling apart those lies, literally within a day or so of them being spread by the Israelis, this is quite this is a bit of a problem for the Israelis. So much of what we just don't know. Hundreds and thousands of stories we do not know because journalists have been killed and also prevented from getting into Gaza, which is now rubble.
That's right. And of course, we heard Trump earlier going on about he'd seen the babies that had been beheaded and of course, he hasn't.
The Israelis were showing journalists films.
They were, yeah, but they didn't have any films of people being beheaded. So in other words, people in the West, I mean, Thangam Debonair, when she was running for Labour MP for this area, apparently she was saying to a Muslim family, but I've seen film of the babies being beheaded. You think, no, you haven't. Because there were no babies beheaded and there's no film of it.
Well, maybe
but people talked as if there was.
No, well, hang on, because the Israelis are showing films, aren't they, privately to, no, they to showed, senior people, the intelligence people no, are they, showing films to yes, but, prospective MPs and city
no,
MPs.
No, they didn't show them to Thangam Debonair. They didn't
so
show
she was just lying, was she?
Yes, she was. And what happens is, it's surprising to think that, Tony, that quite intelligent people, because other people are saying something, they just go along with it, even though it's patently rubbish.
Like this is a career path, basically.
Well, it's partly to do with career, and it's partly to do with groupthink, yeah? Everybody, anyway. if every newspaper in Britain is going on about how 40 babies have been burned in ovens,
anyway,
then if you say anything about it, then you're obviously an anti-Semite, but it turns out, of course, that that's rubbish. It's like the propaganda in the First World War, yeah, about how the Belgians were killing babies. Turned out to be wrong, but it got us going for 4 years,
yes,
didn't it?
Yes, it certainly did. So, yeah, we've got to be very, very careful with the press and what we believe. Don't believe anything on this show, folks, of course. We'd never say that. Oh, you can trust us, like all the others say. Patronisingly. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Ron Mandel. He's here in Bristol, and he was working quite closely with WAFA too. And he sent this little tribute out to Gaza for WAFA, who died just around about a year ago as a journalist based in Gaza.
Hi, my name is Ron Mandel. I'm a volunteer at the Palestine Museum here in Bristol. I was traveling back from Croatia when I heard the devastating news about Wafa's death and the death of her husband and two children at the hands of the IDF terror that's been striking Gaza now for 2 years. I had the distinct honor of knowing Wafa. We had regular Zoom meetings monthly to help the 16th of October group to come up with text that would be suitable for social media platforms. I also worked with David Mowat in organizing two webinars here at the Palestine Museum, where once again she showed exemplary leadership. She allowed her younger colleagues to speak, never dominating the discussion. And throughout both the Zoom meetings and the webinars, she remained a remarkable champion for Palestinian rights, equality, and justice. So even though she's no longer with us, her legacy will live on forever as a champion of Palestinian liberation.
Well, thank you, Ron, and thank you, WAFA. The 16th of October group is a group of journalists who are trying to do their own stuff over there. Obviously, it's not even all that easy with hardly any internet and electricity, Martin.
Well, what may happen now is that the journalists will be able to get in along with aid workers and, you know, some of these stories that have been suppressed can be heard.
But well, of course, that's the last thing the Israelis want.
It is. So, in other words, what I suspect will happen is once the Israeli prisoners have been released, because they are basically prisoners of war, they're soldiers, then they're going to go back to killing because that's all they know how to do.
Okay, so the 16th of October group is not easy to find, though, and very little of their stuff gets... So if anyone is interested, you can find... I'll put a link up to them on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. They have things like WhatsApp groups, I think maybe Telegram too, a YouTube channel which hasn't been used for a while, but they've also got most social media, including Twitter. They've got those sorts of accounts. I mean, they're the only chance we've got to find out what's going on there, Martin, aren't they, really, because Western journalists have been completely kept out.
Yeah, but as various people have pointed out, there's no reason why you couldn't, BBC for example, could employ local journalists, yeah, because that's what Al Jazeera used to do. They didn't send people from Qatar, they would employ local people, but they would be reporting for Al Jazeera, and of course the Western media could have done that, but they chose not to.
Well, our last look at this peace deal, we've really no idea, of course, if it's going to be holding or not. Let's hope to God it does, but the Israelis like people hoping to God and then dashing their hopes, because, of course, they're Gnostics, and they don't really follow proper anything to do with God at all. This is a little cloak that they use. But anyway, like Zionism, generally, the political Zionism, religious Zionism is a different thing. But this is not religious. They're not saying, God, do this. They're saying, no, we're going to pick up a gun and do it ourselves. So here is from some analysis from Richard Wolff and Michael Hudson. They do a very good job regularly looking into all this sort of stuff. So we start with Richard Wolff and move on to Michael Hudson, giving us an idea of how is this whole war or slaughter affecting Israel and the United States and the West's chances internationally.
Nothing is more typical of declining empires than having their leaders do things which everyone shouts at them. Don't do that. That makes your decline worse. But they can't hear it. They're stuck in these ways of doing things. And I don't know whether Netanyahu can either hear any of this. But that's my suspicion. Mr. Trump is realizing it. He's going to have to choose. It's very clear who's going to be sacrificed. You know, the Germans did a Holocaust. They did a genocide. And they are suffering to this day with the reputation they have around the world for that. How it's all played out in a million people's minds. You know, you don't undo this quickly. You know, Hitler is dead in 1945. Here we are 80 years later. And we can still see Germany inside the European Union. I mean, my family is part French and part German. I have lived the lifelong effects of all of this all my life. Even though I'm born in the United States, I'm an American and all of that, I'm fully aware that that is alive and well in a thousand ways. Israel will take a very long time, if ever, to crawl out from under what it has done.
Right.
And Mr. Trump is now telling them, you're going to lose me too, because I'm not going to sacrifice my political life because AIPAC is not able to buy and control the narrative the way Michael laid out. It used to. It was very good at it. We all admired in our way how it did it. But we all knew, if you think about it, it wouldn't last forever. Well, ironically, the most aggressive effort to hold on to it, the Gaza destruction, is also the end of it.
Richard, a few months ago, Netanyahu said that the greatest enemy of Israel are the assimilationist Jews. This is relevant to Mandami's running for election. He right. said, because the assimilationist Jews want to be part of their own society, want to be part of their own economy. They don't look to Israel. They don't put Israel first. And if the American Jews will put America first, European Jews will put European first. They are the enemy. Well, one friend of mine the other day commented that it's as if Netanyahu has read Orwell's 1984, and he took to heart his statement that those who control the present control the past, and those who control the past control the future. And so what Israel's trying to do is to reframe the whole past and the whole history of the settlement of Israel from the very beginning. The Israeli Holocaust, the Nakba, mass assassinations, the whole military history. Well, as I mentioned, to establish all of this, you have to control the narrative. And it's a historical narrative, it's an ongoing news narrative, and it's capped by what students are taught. I want to discuss the economics of how this narrative came about. And I have some personal experience in this. Back in the 1970s, more than seven decades ago, I saw how the groundwork was being laid for the cultural war that was being prepared. I was a Wall Street economist, and some of my oldest friends were working for Drexel Burnham. That was the investment banking firm for corporate raiding junk bond takeovers. And I often met with them, and I addressed their board meetings sometimes. And they told a number of their managers told me that the most important thing to them in their life was Zionism. And Drexel was the investment banking firm that developed the junk bonds to take over companies and turn them into financial vehicles to make capital gains. It was part of the whole transition from America's industrial capitalism to predatory finance capitalism by making buyout offers to take companies to make them into financial vehicles. And the main organizer, Michael Milken, went to jail for organizing insider dealing with Drexel's investors. And the important thing that it was spelled out to me was that these investors were all Jewish. And they were more than Jewish. They were Zionists. And the financial details have been widely reported about all of this, but what is not recognized is that there was sort of a personal compact among all of these investors that they were going to be made very rich by playing by new rules that the white shoe law firms and investment companies wouldn't do, of making hostile takeovers instead of friendly merger proposals. And the deal was they were all expected to give a substantial portion of their earnings to the Zionist cause. And that went beyond AIPAC. It meant to supporting the Zionist cause in many dimensions. And a few decades later, I met with some of the former Drexel strategists who'd gone on to create firms of their own, and they applied this principle that in order to join this corporate raiding, and we're talking about these investors were the ones who took over Silicon Valley and the internet stocks and the information technology stocks. They focused on that from the beginning. They become multi-billionaires, and in the case of Larry Ellison, a trillionaire now. They had they were able to operate with a freedom of attacking the economy at large that the traditional investment banks and companies and law firms didn't. Well, fast forward to the last decade or so. You have the largest investment firms are those of Silicon Valley, and these firms are all led by Zionists working together with Israel and the Likud Party, as well as with AIPAC. They're active in U.S. political campaigns. They're using some of their billions of dollars to promote the Zionist cause, and this attempt to shape American public opinion is centered in the financial sector, and specifically the financial control of the information technology sector, the main platforms for internet communication, everything that I was discussing earlier, where the information war is being fought, including the takeover of CBS News to promote Zionist positions, the takeover of networks here, the takeover of mass media publications, and the huge propaganda within the churches, especially the fundamentalist churches, to give this fake Christianity based on the Scofield Bible and the idea that God told Israel, kill all of the non-Jews so that you'll have the end of history and Jesus can come back and send all of us up to heaven and everyone else to hell. This is the craziness that has been sponsored by essentially by the Israelis pushing the gullible Christian churches to transform, you know, what people think of America as a Christian country not something that either the traditional Catholics or most Protestant churches, as they existed before 1900, would even recognize.
So that's Michael Hudson there. Fascinating insight, isn't it? I mean, really, he's going right, doing the whole full circle there. He's saying, look, well, and I suppose the subtext of it with the ceasefire going on is this is just a bit of a pause. The Israelis have used the genocide to identify where some of the problems are in the mass media and in social media, and to buy them out.
That's right. Oracle, which is owned by Edison, is sometimes said to be more wealthy than
last Elon week he Musk. Was. This week he's not, according
we're not quite
to you.
Sure. But anyway, of course, Oracle are responsible for the bankruptcy of Birmingham City Council because it's them that brought in the computers that
this
didn't work.
This is economic war. This is a Fourth right. Reich, isn't it? It's now, an economic course, warfare
now,
machine.
Let's just pick up on this because these people are not necessarily what you might call traditional entrepreneurs. You know, a traditional entrepreneur like Richard Arkwright invents the spinning jenny.
Well, they may be actually colonels, or they may be military officers, but they just happen to put on a suit, sit in a boardroom, and do a military job by economic warfare, by takeovers, by hostile takeovers, etc. And they're given, instead of ammunition, they're given money in bank accounts to do it.
That's right, but of course it's not traditional entrepreneurial behaviour. As I was saying, Richard Arkwright invents the spinning jenny or whatever. He's somebody that's working in the private sector, and it's all, you know, eventually he has dealings with the government because, of course, you've got to pay your taxes or whatever. But a lot of what was happening with Silicon Valley, it was funded initially by DARPA. So, in other words, the money came for all of these startups from the CIA, from the state. You know, that's, and of course, what people like Bill Gates, for example, are chosen to be the front for it all. So it's not actually entrepreneurial behavior. So they're manipulating the state to get themselves into a position where they can make money on these developments, you know, the development of the social media and the internet and all the rest of it. And then, of course, they're then going to use that to control everybody's minds, which, of course, is what they're trying to do. And, you know, not all billionaires are Zionists, but a hell of a lot of them are. And of course, what we could say, if I was Birmingham City Council or Britain's government, is okay, Oracle, you've got a very, very strong pro-Zionist position. Therefore, you're not suitable to bid for contracts in this country because you're not just an independent business, are you?
Well, they'll then sue you because they've got enough money to pay an army of barristers to go and get
well,
you.
Well, they probably have, but also, of course, you could argue that we're not. Yeah, this is unfair competition because you've got all this support from the Israeli government and all the rest of it. So,
yeah, but they'll lose in court when the Freemason judge bangs his little mallet or his gavel. Oh, I'm sorry, you've lost. I'm a Freemason, but I'm not telling you. Anyway, we'll just have the Patricia Opulenza poem of the week. Points for prizes. Wasteland, the price for peace, hear tell. From demons joined to Israel. No blood or bones or children's cries be washed away by builders nigh. Construct, destruct where once was home on Gaza Strip, where death now roams. Where children played before they died, starved and killed by genocide. No towers tall, nor gated homes, nor lux resort on blood and bones. No sweeping clean, nor broom can swill the stench of death, nor ever will. No fancy lifestyle money spent for Gaza, genocide, laments. Appointees smile for camera roll. No deal be sealed upon death's toll. No papers signed or contracts sworn or lines in sand for truce be drawn. Or 20 points for peace prize plea. Free hostages no bell may see. We'll pay the price for all the dead of children shot in face and head, of mother's screams, of father's cries in Gaza, land of genocide. Thank you, Patricia. We've all got our fingers crossed for. We really don't know what's going on. But, Martin, it's quite possible the Israelis are just going to use this to regroup and maybe, as I've been hearing, attack Iran.
Well, that's obviously something we haven't discussed, but that's also on the agenda because they've been moving all these refueling aircraft from the US to Europe. And the last time they did that, they attacked Iran. So, of course, what they could do. You see, what will happen now with the ceasefire is that the Yemenis and Hezbollah will go with Hamas on this. If Hamas got a ceasefire, we've got a ceasefire. That's always been the position. And while that's the case, then they can isolate Iran and attack Iran. And of course, you know, Hamas ought to, because since they've been supported by Iran for years, if Iran is attacked, Hamas should join in against Israel, but of course they're not in a position to do that. Probably
they didn't do very well against Iran last time, so
no, they didn't. So I mean, it's a very poor decision.
They might decide
a
few nuclear weapons might be useful.
Well, they'll have to use nuclear weapons if they want to win. That's why Israel is a threat, not just to the people of Gaza. It's a threat to us. If they use nuclear weapons, there's going to be probably a nuclear war in which we're all going to die, so that they can have greater Israel. I tell you what, if it's going to be us or them, it's definitely going to be them.
So what do you think of the prospects of something? I mean, even if the people of Gaza are left alone for a little while, some aid gets in, people start being fed, etc., that the war will continue somewhere else, that the Israelis will just, the eye of Sauron in Tel Aviv will be staring over in towards Tehran.
I think what we've got to deal with is that the Israeli state is a rogue state. Ultimately, there's not much deals to be done with it. It's going to, you know, the two-state solution, even though the Chinese and the Russians are still pushing it, I think it's dead. It's finished. There's going to be one state, and it's going to be called Palestine.
Anyway,
and if Israelis don't like that, they'll have to go back to New York, where many of them come from.
Or actually Moscow.
Well, yes, there's quite a large Russian population there as well.
Okay,
that's right.
So,
but they're not locals. Yeah,
no, of course, they're not.
The Palestinians, you can say, well, you never lived around here, and you just come here from Russia.
That's right. The Palestinians had their own right.
And you've got
right
somewhere to go.
To
you can go back to Russia. You've got a Russian passport. Go to Russia.
They had their own right to return march, didn't they? Which didn't go too well. A lot of Israeli Defence Force people were shooting them. But anyway, I mean, we had Joe Banks, local freelance journalist, who's now moved out of Bristol, it seems. But he was here in the spring, wasn't he, talking about this amazing, I mean, talking about economic warfare by the Israel lobby. Big development at the Bear Pit, which is carrying on. It's by this company, Minora Mitchevin. These massive student flats, which are being built right in the centre of Bristol here, Martin. This whole student world is being... It's almost as if the students are the only people that have got any money, because it's all a loan, a guaranteed loan. And so massive amounts of money is coming into the city to build these student accommodation, because they know the students are one of the only people who've got any money, even though it is borrowed funny money.
Yes, and of course, some of it isn't borrowed money, it's foreign students, but at the same time, that's all money, and it's guaranteed money. So obviously, if you're going to build big tower blocks to house these people, then you can make a lot of money. Unless, of course, word gets around that you are, in fact, Zionist genocidaires, and the students might not want to live in your flats.
Yeah, in fact, might blockade them.
Yeah, it might not be viable.
So long as they know where the money's coming. Anyway, this is Joe's brilliant work in pointing all this out. So let's have a listen now to the Iraq war whistleblower, Catherine Gunn, I mentioned earlier. She's talking here, I think, about the financial system, the Israelis' involvement in the fix to after the crash. So lots of things get talked about in the longer interview, but here she talks about, particularly about students and the position of students and universities and why the universities have become so powerful in cities like Bristol here, but also this idea of the Pax Judaica that may be to come in the future, and maybe actually there now, but we don't even know it's there. I prefer to call it Pax Zionica, because it's not really got much to do with Judaism. It's got much more to do with the Zionist project and Israel, or Pax Israelia or something. But anyway, this is the way it's been characterised, that we had a Pax Romana, that you wouldn't have peace unless you did what the Romans told you. The same with the British Empire, then the Americans, and now Pax Judaica. But she starts by talking about the situation for students, and her family are up in Durham, and she's recently gone back to Turkey from Durham. But she's talking here about how the student, you know, the basic situation for students in Britain now, they're in a kind of financial trap.
The British Empire ostensibly collapsed in the 1940s and transferred over to the American Empire. So there is a Islamic scholar who I don't know, not many people have probably heard of him, Sheikh Imran Hussein. He is a elderly gentleman from Trinidad, and even among the Islamic world, he's not sort of really recognized because basically he deals in geopolitics. He researches from within the Quran and tries to develop a eschatological a view, an end times view of the world or a current view of the world based on geopolitics and his understanding of the Quran and looking into the future of that as well. So his view is not widely accepted by the Islamic community. However, I think he has a lot of valid points, and having studied international relations, he went on from Geneva to Pakistan and studied under, back in the 50s and the 60s, before Pakistan got poisoned by Saudi-driven Islamic thought. He studied under some scholars, Islamic scholars, and came to a worldview and an understanding of the Quran that is quite different. And he's written several books. One of his, I haven't got hold of his books yet. They're quite hard to get hold of. One of his books he wrote about 25 years ago called Jerusalem in the Quran. And in that book, he lays out his understanding, which is that we had a period of Pax Britannica, as he called it. So, you know, obviously this refers to the Roman Empire, but the first global empire was Pax Britannica. And so he labels that as the first global empire, which at the time used the sovereign pound as the global currency, the sterling as the global currency. When Pax Britannica went bust and basically had to cede its global currency power and cede its sort of dominant control over to Pax Americana, that began the period of the American Empire. So Pax Britannica was around 300 years. Pax Americana you could describe as being around 100 years from the 1940s up to today, or maybe a bit before the 1940s. And they used the American dollar followed by the petrodollar. And now the American Empire is bust. The Pax Americana is bust. He says the next empire that will follow these two is Pax Judaica. So Pax, he believes we have now entered Pax Judaica. So the Jewish state of Israel is acting in the manner of an imperial power, and it's beholden upon everyone to take that seriously, to acknowledge that they now believe they have absolute dominance over the world in terms of how they act. Nobody is prepared to intervene. Nobody is prepared to really shut them down. And he says this will continue. However, as the American Empire lasted a shorter period of time than the British Empire, so Pax Judaica will last for an even shorter period than Pax Americana. However, you know, he won't say exactly how long he thinks it would last. It could be 20 years, it could be 30, it could be 50 or less. I don't know. But he says they are not going to be able to create a global currency based on the shekel. So what they will do is have a digital currency. And he believes that this push towards a digital currency is driven by the people behind Pax Judaica, who want to maintain this power. So he goes into a lot more detail about his view of how this will pan out, including a global war, including potentially the destruction of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and so on and so forth. But for him, you know, because he comes from a religious worldview, he believes that God will triumph in the end. So he believes that, the Jews will want their Messiah to return. And in order for their so-called Messiah to return, they need to build the third temple. And that they will do this, but the Muslim population and the Christian population will view the Jewish so-called Messiah as the Antichrist. And so he believes that eventually the Muslims and the Christians, the Orthodox Christians, and he specifies that it will be the Orthodox Christians and not the woke sort of European and American Christians, but the Orthodox Christians who will unite with the Muslims to overthrow this tyrannical system, which, you know, is the Pax Judaica, or will be the Pax Judaica. And so that just a brief sort of outline is what Sheikh Imran Hussein tries to share with the world his understanding.
So that's Catherine Gunn speaking to me yesterday. So she's just saying this is an interesting concept that this guy Imran Hussein is, and she backs it up in the longer interview. I'll put that up later, maybe have another clip from her next week, because it doesn't do her justice just hearing that little section. Martin, this idea that there's actually some sort of spiritual battle going on here, maybe that the Orthodox Church, that sounds to me like the Russians get involved.
Well, I'm loath to get involved with people predicting the future based on religious beliefs of any kind, because
But she's saying, okay, just a minute, you don't believe it. Yeah, well, look, just a minute, what about the Third Temple? It's quite clear that there is some sort of provocation being prepared by the Israelis, the idea of the Al-Aqsa Mosque being demolished and the Third Temple being constructed by the Israelis. I mean, surely that's
straightforward, because that's what they want to do.
But how it fits in with the Islamic prophecy is interesting, isn't it?
It is, but I mean, the point is, are they going to be able to do it? And I would argue that they probably aren't, or it's not going to work out in the way people predict. I think if we're just relying on, some kind of religious intervention here, we're missing the point.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's what she's talking about at all, or he is. It's saying that this is how the hearts of men around the world are going to, which directions they're going in. And also, whether a system of control is brought in, this will provoke a reaction. So there's going to be a fight over it.
There's definitely going to be a fight over it. And as you said earlier, they've got nuclear weapons. So it could very well be, if the Iranians do what they should do, which is to wipe out the Israeli defense forces with hypersonic missiles, that they'll get their nuclear weapons out and nuke Iran, which will, of course, cause absolute catastrophe for the whole Middle East. And then everybody will die in a nuclear war. I suppose that is the rapture. So there we are. And when all Jesus will save someone.
The rapture is rubbish.
Well, of course it is, but we could all die in a nuclear war. That's perfectly straightforward. You don't need any religious beliefs to see that, staring us in the face.
So, I think the rapture was brought in under the Scofield Bible, so that's a bit of a bogus thing to throw in there. There's been a lot of chat this week about the occult, which is, several people messaged me this, and I couldn't quite believe it when I saw it last weekend, which is Tucker Carlson embracing this interesting guest who talks about the occult. Let's have just a dip into that now. The interview is called The Occult, Kabbalah and the Antichrist, the newest manifestation and how to avoid the mark of the beast. So Tucker Carlson going into some really interesting territory with this guy from Hollywood who's been making films about the occult, trying to examine what is really going on and what they're really up to, because a large part of this is to do with this obsession with AI. We've got human beings making decisions in history, but what about the idea of human beings not making the decisions that the fascists or those in charge really want, the oligarchy want? Well, they can bring out AI and let AI make those decisions.
3 years ago, as I was doing the show, I was talking with these VCs, and one of them asked me, like, what's your take on crypto? And I joked, half joked. I was like, you're asking the wrong guy about crypto and money and stuff like that. And I said, well, you know, a lot of Christians believe that the vaccine, the COVID vaccine, is the mark of the beast. And I said, it's probably not true. I said, but something I've heard, and something that sounds a lot more like it, is blockchain technology, which is the technology we'll all be using in a few years, for financial transaction, among other things. It's everything's written and recorded, and every kind of transaction is written and recorded on it. And these VCs, they go, well, what's the mark of the beast? So I tell them about Book of Revelation. They go and look up Revelation 13, and they go, huh. And so I hear back from them later, and they said, yeah, we talked to some of the big, other big people in Silicon Valley about this, recognizable people. And he said, well, what's the book of Revelation? What's the mark of the beast? And some other big dogs looked it up. And their reaction to that was, huh, that sounds like what that is. It was not, Tucker, that sounds crazy, or I'm not religious, or what we're working on is strange. But the Bible is an old book. We have nothing to worry about there. The reaction was, yeah, that sounds exactly like what the blockchain technology is. So that was the beginning of me kind of stumbling into a very strange story about, AI, modern technology and stuff like that.
So I think part of what you're revealing is that for the rest of us who assumed the tech barons were
normies.
Yeah, or agnostic libertarians,
right,
who aren't that interested in anything beyond the temporal.
Right.
It turns out they're really religious.
Yes.
Or open to it. Like and I don't mean that as a compliment at all. I mean, it's like a dark religion, but like the story you just told, like they're not surprised at all.
Well, here's something else that is very strange that happened. So Mark Andreessen was on Joe Rogan's podcast about a year or two ago, and he talked about how, having an understanding of angels and demons, he's hearing, is going to be how people really will help them in understanding AI, that there's no precedent for this except for the kind of stuff people saw and believed in the Dark Ages in terms of angels and demons and stuff. And what Andreessen said will happen soon with AI ties in very much with prophecies in the Book of Revelation, where he said AI will junk, fake AI, say they call it AI slop, just stuff online that's not real, will become so prolific on the internet very soon that you will need to have some sort of online verification system.
Exactly.
To prove who you're talking to. I mean, I'll know it gets to the case Tucker here, where like there's an episode of the Tucker Carlson podcast and you're talking to like Abraham Lincoln or something like that.
Which will probably happen next week.
I would watch that. They'll have like, right. I'll have a commemorative penny or something like that. And you'll ask him if he...
Why did you suspend habeas corpus in Baltimore? My first question.
You'll ask him, do you forgive John Wilkes Booth?
Right.
And then he'll go back to like talking about the pennies.
Were you a tyrant? That is coming like immediately. So the verification.
So one of the ideas that Andreessen brings up is everyone will need to have an online verification for this. So the concern in Silicon Valley is that you have companies like OpenAI where they have they're creating all this AI content, but then they have another company, a sister company called WorldCoin, I think now called just World, which is an online verification system where you need to for it to work, everyone has to be a part of it. You have to have your eyeballs scanned. Everyone gets a number, which is also not Book of Revelation. And so the concern is, and this is again from Mark Andreessen, a guy that, no Kentucky preacher. He's one of the biggest guys in Silicon Valley, is that everyone will need to be on the blockchain or else you won't be able to conduct business, because we won't know if your relatives are contacting you, if that's really coming from them, or if this is just a video state-of-the-art, in a few years it will be normal, state-of-the-art video of someone saying, hey, Dad, you know, I lost my credit card, or, you know, I lost the keys to the house. Can you pin me in? And it's actually not them. It's just a video that looks exactly like them, but it's AI. The way around that is everyone will need to essentially be Twitter verified. Everyone will need the blue tick that says, this is Tucker Carlson, this is so-and-so.
Right. So in Revelation, written on the Isle of Patmos by John, on recording a vision that he had, the specific description of the mark of the beast in the book of Revelation says you won't be able to conduct commerce.
Yes.
Without that mark.
And even someone like,
did I get that right?
Yeah, no, that is correct. And I think, Curtis Yarvin's talked about that in Substack too, that, what this means, he had a post about this a few years ago about OpenAI, where he was like, whoever wins the AI war will probably also win the cryptocurrency war. Their cryptocurrency gets to be the currency. And once that happens, and Curtis has a whole blog post about it, people joke, you know, you have automated luxury communism. You know, everyone just get, you know, UBI, everyone gets free income, right? Because all the jobs are taken away. And the point Curtis makes is that what this actually means is now that there is no more jobs, and that economics purely come down to UBI and the AI companies or the governments, you are dealing with the situation of pure political power is all that really matters. And are you friends with this person? Do you have political clout? Because what is coming potentially is the pure victory of capital over labor. Pure victory. And there are no workers. Everyone loses their job and everyone gets UBI. And people forget Karl Marx was against UBI, but Milton Friedman was for it. So this doesn't even necessarily track with a left or right wing thing in terms of the implications of this.
So that's Tucker Carlson there having a chat with Conrad Flynn, who's a film producer, Hollywood filmmaker, program maker. He's taking us through this concept, really, that the blockchain is like a prison. But also talking about things like universal basic income. Now, I mean, this is something that we would like to see. Everyone should have an income. But I suppose, in a way, universal basic income is compensation for lost land, because you don't have anywhere to live. You need to pay all these other people for this, that, and everything else. And that universal basic income could be a trap as well, actually, Martin.
Well, just like universal credit, but I have
I
have to claim it because I can't pay the rents otherwise.
Exactly.
And that's true before digital things came along, when it was all done on card file.
But
indexes.
This is a kind of formalizing it and digitizing it, isn't it? The digital.
Yeah, but
version.
It's the same. It's a continuation of the capitalist mechanism of social control.
It's a system of
money.
Slavery.
Money.
Slavery.
Well, money is the mechanism of social
control.
Because
if you can't make money, you're just a slave.
That's right. Now, the problem with this is even, I think Trotsky wrote years ago, it's actually in the original Communist Manifesto. Ultimately, what communism is, conceived by Marx and Engels in the 1840s, is that because they were very, very keen on the productive capacity of capitalism, that in actual fact this is a new social system where science is put in the service of society, and things are not going to be the same going forwards. And ultimately, of course, the problem is that the organic composition of capital constantly changes in favor of more and more capital intensive production. So you need more and more machines and software and all the rest of it, and less people. Now, the problem with that is that people get pushed out of the process, and therefore they've got no money to spend, and therefore capitalism becomes unstable, because if you put everybody out of work, which is what happened in the 1930s, capitalism doesn't work. Now, the whole idea of universal basic income is we're going to put you all out of work, but we're going to give you a dole to keep you, like bread and circuses. But of course, that's not enough to keep the whole thing in balance.
It's not necessarily permanent either. That could be taken away.
That could be taken away at any stage.
And it could just be used to discipline you, like the social credit
that's right,
system
that's right.
In China.
But, I mean, but of course, the conception of revolution in the original Communist Manifesto and the German ideology all the rest of it, is that the impoverishment of the proletariat, which is the majority of society, will lead to a situation where there'll be a political revolution against the owners of capital, the Silicon billionaires. And of course, the implication of that is, you know, French Revolution style, they're going to be beheaded and we're going to take their machines and we're going to run for us. Yeah. Now, that is the original. And ultimately, of course, socialism is, as it says in the Critique of the Gotha Program, socialism is moving from to each being paid according to their ability and to their contribution to society. So there won't be completely equal wages in socialism. And of course, this is what the Chinese are saying. We're developing a socialist system here in China. Communism is in the future. But of course, what communism is, as originally conceived, and Marx and Engels conceived it like this, machines will do all the work and people will not have to work. That's communism.
No, they'll just have to do as they're told. States of emergency.
Well, it can be. It could work
states,
out like that.
States of emergency is Cees van der Pael's book. He talks about the idea of permanent situation where because the people are being deprived of loads of basic stuff, so there has to be some kind of control grid surveillance system that the owners of capital have to keep everyone under control, so they're ready for a sort of making sure that there's no ability for people to organize and fight back against them.
That's right. Well, that's what they're trying to organize, but of course it is actually a fight. Yeah, they've not actually managed.
What? Another thing, he didn't actually mention it there, but it's exactly what Yanis Varoufakis was talking about, isn't it? Techno-feudalism.
That's right. But of course, it's still a fight. They don't get it all their own way. Hamas, as we speak, there's a ceasefire. And of course, the Palestinians were all cheering, which is really annoying for the Israelis, because they're all cheering and because they've won. Hamas are better.
Have they won?
No, they're in a better condition now, the fighters, than they were 3 years ago. They've got more fighters and more kit, and they're trained.
I think you might find people in Gaza having a different opinion to that. Anyway, look, Martin,
let's have an election and then see who wins it.
Yeah.
They won in 2006. I think they're going to win again if there's an election.
I don't think so. Well, I don't think so.
Well, let's have an election sorted out.
I mean, you know, yeah, so I think the idea that everyone is just cheering Hamas on over there is absolute nonsense. What they're doing is they're, thank God, that we're not being killed anymore. So, and the same exact on the other side, many of the Israelis are not cheering Netanyahu. They're just saying, thank God someone stopped him.
Yeah, well, no, they want their hostages back. 80% of them want the Palestinians dead, which is why we can't make peace with them. They're going to have to go, well, just like the Algerian settlers in Algeria.
Yes,
they're going to have to go.
You may have a point there. So finally tonight, as a sort of spin-off from that Tucker Carlson interview, it was fascinating to see that Nick Land, because he comes up a lot in that interview, the author of The Dark Enlightenment, the sort of visionary for the tech giants, this old school friend of mine, Nick Land, he comes up in that interview a lot, the one that we just heard. And so here's a clip of it. They did a discussion between Alexander Dugin, who is a Russian philosopher, with Nick Land, who's a British philosopher now based in Shanghai. So let's have a listen to a bit of that now. Dugin first, and then a bit of Nick Land.
I totally agree with your analysis about Chinese culture. And what you have said about the empty summit, it's a very important concept. I think that we need to understand that empire, classical empire, sacred empire, was precisely defined by transcendental nature of the summit. So the summit is not filled with some positive meaning. It is open. The summit is open. That is the very, very, very natural sacredness. The same with emperor, who is high, who is hidden, who is outside. So the same for the classical, traditional, philosophical empire. Empire is ruled by empty space, empty summit. Empty summit is apophatical political concept. You are absolutely right about that. So it should be held open to the spiritual influence, to be filled by some extra human presence. And that is very functional elements. So, and in my opinion, I have made my suggestions in my XCOM account concerning your concept of cathedral, your concept of Curtis Yarvin. So I think that there may be the much more correct concept would be for cathedral republic. A republic, it's something close on the summit. The summit is totally closed. So it is purely profane, nothing sacred, nothing, no openness to the high, and only self-reliance on the same immanent rational organization. So everything great comes from empire, from the political concept, social, philosophical concept with empty summit. That is the key element. Empty summit, apophatical top.
It seems to me that your fourth political theory is in a double sense Heideggerian. Like, it's Heideggerian because you talk about Heidegger a lot, and Heidegger is the key to you to actually kind of organizing what is going to be substantially and positively the fourth political theory. But it's also that your work is structured very similar to Heidegger's in the sense that actually it's question. You know, the structure of the book is a question. And the substantive work that Heidegger's doing in terms of eliminating metaphysical ontologies, idols of being, and in terms that are most interesting to you, idols of the human, you too are spending, you know, the substance of the book is clearing away these idols of the position that would be the fourth political theory, and to understood correctly, the fourth political theory, like the question of being for Heidegger, is actually a question being posed articulately by your book, not something that can be just understood as another object level claim that you're proposing some model of politics as a substitute for these idols that you're wanting to demolish. And so, I mean, I guess I'm saying on that, do you think that is a sound approach to what you're doing in that work and on that line of inquiry?
Well, that's Nick Land there. Before that, Alexander Dugin. It's been put out as a sort of Dugin versus Land, but of course it's not really. They're both agreed on pretty much everything. But as someone that studied philosophy, Martin, I mean, I find that a little bit difficult, other than what Nick is saying really is that historically we had religious idols. We've now got politics, which is replacing that. But it's also starting to fall to bits, politics is. So what do you make of what, you know, he's talking about Heidegger there. He talks a lot about Nietzsche in other parts of that talk. What do you make of what they're chatting about?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm just reading a philosophy textbook at the moment, just for fun. And being an Englishman, I find a lot of this stuff just doesn't make sense. It's like they just make stuff up. Heidegger. Have you ever tried to read Heidegger? It's incomprehensible drivel.
Well, actually, if you try and read Nick, I'm afraid, sorry Nick, if you're listening, it's incomprehensible drivel.
Well, you see, the best philosophy is, in fact, still Plato with Socrates, and you can understand what's going on, and you can see the points that are being made, but what modern philosophy has got a lot of, they invent lots of new ideas with a new name for it, Dasein. Dasein, Tony, it's a very important Heideggerian concept. Incidentally, by the way, Heidegger was a card-carrying member of the Nazi Party. So all of his philosophical views led him to be a supporter of the Führer.
As you know, Nazi Nick was Nick's nickname at school, because he was a Nazi. Mm. And he was a big, big fan of Hitler's favourite person in the whole world, who was Nietzsche.
Yes, well,
in fact, much of the world philosophy departments of universities are Nietzschean. They are pretty much, if you're a Nietzschean,
well,
you get yourself a job.
Not in America
in
or
day.
Britain.
No, not really.
I mean, there's two big traditions in philosophy, modern philosophy. One is what you might call the continental tradition. I'm interested in both.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm still basically English, and if you can't explain it in straightforward language, it's probably drivel.
Isn't it?
I'm afraid that's how I was taught.
The whole point of philosophy, really, is to just replace God, isn't it?
No, the whole point of philosophy is to be very careful how you use words so that you don't make mistakes about stuff. Mm. In fact, Socrates and Confucius...
It's an alternative to the spiritual, isn't it, really?
No, plenty of philosophers have been believers of various kinds. So but philosophy overlaps with religious belief. Some philosophers aren't religious, many are.
I think Nick is a believer of some sort. I mean, what he believes in, I'm not sure. His thing, the Dark Enlightenment, has inspired many people. But anyway, so I'll put a full version of that up on your show page if you want something to try and help you go to sleep at night or give you bad dreams. Anyway, so it's interesting that this stuff is all starting to come out. Well done, Tucker Carlson, for starting it. And I'll put, obviously, the full link to that show up, which is about an hour and a half, chatting about how Nick fits into much of what's going on.
Nick and Dugan, were they on Tucker Carlson?
No. That was a separate thing, which was a kind of spin-off from Tucker, because
so everybody's talking about it now because Tucker's talking about it.
Well, yes, and good. I mean, we've been talking about it on and off for years, but yes, it's now becoming a little bit mainstream. Thoughts and prayers for the people of Gaza. Let's just hope things work out for them over the next few days, particularly, and into the long-term future. Maybe we could just finish, Martin, by saying something about the Northern Ireland peace process and whether there may be lessons from that for people in Gaza. Because at least at the end of the IRA struggle, the IRA still very much able to bomb and fight their way around. They were blowing up the City of London, for example, when they came to negotiate. But the poor old Gazans have got very little negotiating power, have they? They've got very little in terms of what they can do back to the Israelis in terms of a fight and a battle. They're really on the back foot, which the IRA actually weren't.
Well, the IRA were, and eventually, of course, they had to put all of their weaponry beyond use, I suppose.
At the peace agreement, yes. Yeah.
That's right. Well, I mean, I think from a military point of view, Hamas are not defeated. And, of course, if the Israelis are stupid enough to attack Iran, then the real war will start. Okay?
Maybe that's what they want.
Maybe it is what they want. It's absolutely stupid of them, because the real hope is that the Iranians, I was talking to Iranians this week, the Iranians have tried to avoid a fight with the Israelis, have bent over backwards to avoid it. But I think even the moderates in the Iranian government have now realised we are going to have to deal with this.
It's a bit like Russia with Ukraine, isn't it? And the
Brits.
That's right.
At some point you have to fight, and if you're going to fight, you fight to win.
So it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest Matt O'Brannan and to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and to Catherine Gunn, also sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Sorry, didn't have time again for Madda London. Just so much going on right at the moment. We'll have her next week and her friend Tom Palmer, who she thinks may have been bumped off by MI5. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. tonight to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please share interviews and story tips on the Tony Gosling Censored Telegram channel and via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page. That has got the podcast on, the full-length interviews, the story links and the comment page. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter by email. And if you can afford it, do please donate or even set up a small monthly sub. Particular thanks to all those that do at thisweekoneword.org.uk. So we've been streaming at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at Holy Land Radio in Wisconsin, 11 till 2:30 Central Time, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show updated app. Get it from GitHub, and that link is at thisweek.org.uk. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, let me know and we'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic hamsters get you down.
I digger, I digger, was a boozy beggar who could think you under the table. David Hume could out-consume Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And Wittgenstein was a beery swine who's just a slosh to Schlegel. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. George Stuart Mill of his own free will, on hot water shiny was particularly ill. Wait till they say, could sing it away. Have a grain of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a banker for the bottle. Hobbes was fond of his dram. And Rene Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am. Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thing about a bugger when he's pissed.
Take a look. How melodic.
Salvar meu coração. matar o seu coração. Água de beber, água de beber, camarada. Água de beber, água de beber, camarada. Te batunda, bate la da badaba, te batunda, bate la da badaba, te batunda. Entrei pra escola do perdão. A minha casa vive aberta. Abre todas as portas do coração. Água de beber, água de beber, camarada. Água de beber. Badaba, te batunda, badaba, te batunda.